Thursday on the Riff on 101 WRIS.
It really rocks.
Well, begin transmission.
Here comes the music.
It's a Riff.
We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment. This is 101 WRIF, broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. Thanks for listening.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Antonio's Cucina Italiana, with three locations in Farmington Hills, Dearborn Heights, and Dearborn.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roche, put your best pace and body forward with help from Dr. Roche.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll.
At WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
I think, by God, Bush can't finish his job. He was aimed to take care of his dad's problems. Didn't finish that in 91. And he damn sure ain't got this sumbitch finished now.
No, no, it's going to take a long time.
I mean, you know what I'd do. Hell, I'd split that son of a bitch wide open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd use them bomb planes and bombs, and I'd have everybody scared to look up.
But you know, the thing of it is, after all is said and done, we still don't have Saddam Hussein. Can you believe it?
I don't know if they're supposed to have his sons, but...
Oh, Dell, you don't think they got his sons necessarily?
Who knows whether it's his sons
sure.
or not.
Did you see the pictures of them?
Yeah, I seen the pictures of them, but all them sons bet you look alike. Just picture one and turn him sideways, he'll look like half a dozen more.
Drew,
that sounds good.
And Mike, hey. In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101 WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Just trying to make sure all the little buttons are pushed correctly, although it sure still sounds weird. Oh, well, all right, I'll keep talking. Hi, keep talking. Da, 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 da. Yeah, all right. A little technical thing here. So join me, 313-298-WRIF. Why am I getting this slight echo here? Well, why I said welcome back is I just drove in from Washington, D.C. If you watch television or saw some of the news reports, you get the idea that there were tens of thousands, as the media said, tens of thousands of people in Washington, D.C. protesting the Iraq war, Bush's policy, and demanding that the United States troops be withdrawn from Iraq and replaced by what? Well, that's a longer discussion. But that's... I actually had some thoughts in general about it all. If you saw any of it, or if you were there, if you were one of the tens of thousands, the organizers said there was 100,000. The New York Times said there was 10,000. I don't know, to some extent, I just talked to a friend, and she said, well, how many do you think were there? And I said, I don't know. I was in the middle of a really big crowd. And here's the New York Times. You know, these papers suck so bad. On a bright autumn day, that's true, the mood of the demonstration borrowed heavily from the imagery of the 1960s peace protests over Vietnam as college students and other young people in tie-dyed shirts and bandanas waved placards bearing peace signs and exhorted the White House to make love, not war. Well, you know, I mean, you know, I just don't even know where to start with this. For one thing, borrowing the imagery of the 1960s peace protests over Vietnam. First off, I think that would be a good thing. Secondly, I probably did see a few young people in tie-dyed shirts. I was struck, though, about what an ordinary cross-section of America this all was, from very young people to elderly people and everyone in between. And there were, you know, there were. In fact, I was thinking that it wasn't as colorful in terms of the kind of, I don't know, pattern of people that you see. Like if you go to a rock concert, you certainly see a lot more people in tie-dyed shirts. It depends on, you know, sometimes you go to a concert, it's called people all have black T-shirts on, right? Kind of depends on what it is. But, you know, this is just bad journalism. And, you know, the editor, sometimes, well, ultimately, it's the any bad writing is the responsibility of editors. But they like this because what it does two things. It makes it seem very exotic, and it also makes it seem marginal. But it also gives the impression of, hey, this is a democracy. It's a pluralist society. We don't have just one particular, or one, how could you put it, one line coming from the government that's unchallenged. We allow these big demonstrations, even if they borrow heavily from the imagery of the 1960s peace protests over Vietnam, and hence are exotic and hence are marginal. Still, we allow the people to say outrageous things like make love, not war, and impeach George W. Bush, and the like. But everybody knows that it's not a part of the full political discourse in a democratic society. Because we all know where real, authentic political discourse in a democratic society appears, at least now. It appears on television. It's carried out by mostly men wearing suits, mostly men who are already in government, and mostly men who are conservative. There's a few that pose as liberals, and recently there's even some who are critical of the government. But the people that are in the streets, they're marginal, they're exotic, they are borrowing heavily from the imagery of the 1960s peace protests over Vietnam. I have to say, I never saw one sign saying, make love, not war. Had I known this was going to be an issue, I would have carried one proudly. Peace signs. There were a lot of those, backed by popular demand in a maniacal war government that sees its success in getting its right-wing agenda through to reshape America by virtue of war. So we have the most far-right-wing, the most far-right-wing religious, and the most warlike administration in the history of the United States. So when people attempt to take part in the political discourse in a democratic society and they are shunted aside because the only people that are allowed to speak fully and are given the authenticity by virtue of being on television, what does that do to people that don't fit that? Well, you then have to do what people have done historically and have done all over the world. You go outside of the medium that's officially allowed by the authorities, whether it's in 1776 or the 1930s or the 1960s or 2003. And one of the chants was, what does a democratic society look like? This is what a democratic society looks like. And people were saying, in other words, democracy is in the streets. And that was even the title of a book about the 1960s. And yet, I don't. I went to the demonstration. My wife and I, and other people I knew, we met in Washington D.C. and we took part in the festivities and the serious march and listened to the speeches and what have you. But you have to remember that the reason that we've done all this is that people with opinions that don't meet the official version of reality are excluded from the political discourse. And the masters of war that run this society know that very well, because they saw what happened to Tony Blair. If you allow an authentic political discourse in a democratic society, your lies get exposed much quicker than the lies of George W. Bush have been exposed, because Tony Blair had to face opposition from all sorts of daily newspapers that didn't just report whatever he said uncritically, that just didn't repeat every bit of foolishness that came out of the mouths of Tony Blair and George W. Bush. Every lie, every misrepresentation, every attempt to strike fear into our hearts to make us lose our critical sense of what was happening. And now we see this coming home to roost. $87 billion going for the necessity for this fool's errand that George W. Bush and Colin Powell and Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and the rest of them, Paul Wolfowitz, And what did it look like in Iraq today? It looked like Tet. Tet. T-E-T. In 1968, there was what was called the Tet Offensive. This was at a time after the country had gone through the lies of Lyndon Johnson and then gone through the lies of Richard Nixon. And we were told all the time that there's a light at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam. The United States would soon be successful. All the people welcomed us. We were loved. We were reconstructing Vietnam in a democratic manner. We were fighting communism. We would soon be victorious. That the armed forces of Vietnam would soon be capable on their own of resisting the subversion of the old regime. And then there was the Tet Offensive, where the Vietnamese launched attacks all over Vietnam in with such ferocity that it gave lie to this light at the end of the tunnel, soon be successful rhetoric. In other words, the lies of those administrations back in the 1960s. I wonder why the New York Times never uses that rhetoric when they are describing our rulers, when they're describing the masters of war of this generation. Why they don't say, on a bright autumn day, the mood of war borrowed heavily from the lie, from the imagery of the lies that the government forced upon the people of the United States. Wonder why they don't say, why don't they say, rather than as college students and other young people in tie-dyed shirts and bandanas wave placards, why don't they say it's the same men in the same suits that told the same lies to the American people? They don't say that. So the Tet Offensive was launched by the Vietnamese to show that there wasn't a light at the end of the tunnel. And maybe this is what happened. I think many of you probably know that the U.S. Occupation Authority retreated from its headquarters Sunday after Iraqi insurgents used rocket launchers to attack the heavily guarded hotel with a missile barrage that killed an American colonel, wounded 18 other people, and sent the visiting Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, scurrying for safety. This is what George W. Bush has brought the United States to in Baghdad. Officials of the U.S. Army and of the U.S. government running out of the Al-Rashid Hotel in their underwear and their PJs, closing the hotel, saying we can't secure the safety of Americans in that hotel. And hopefully we'll get some clothes to the guys that are just running around in their skivvies. In the understatement of the... Now, what I was going to say, year? Maybe just the day or the week. Colin Powell, exposed as a liar by his own people for his statements at the United Nations. Colin Powell says, we'll have to get the security situation under control. Well, you'd think so. The modern 462-room Al-Rashid, which is the hotel, housing civilian officials at the U.S.-led Coalition Provisional Authority and U.S. military personnel, is a symbol of the occupation. The assaults highlighted the vulnerability of even heavily guarded U.S. facilities in Iraq. Now, this is the symbol of the U.S. occupation. Let's call it the Bush occupation. And they had to run out of there in their underwear. You know, there was an article about, an editor and publisher. Editor and Publisher is a magazine that surveys, the printed word. And it's like the trade publication. And they were talking about how the press underreports the wounded in Iraq, because we always hear that 100 men and women have died since Bush declared an end to hostilities in March. But Seth Porges writes in Editor and Publisher for October 23rd, few newspapers routinely report injuries in Iraq beyond references to specific incidents. Since the war began in March, almost 2,000 soldiers have been wounded in Iraq. Suddenly it sounds a little grimmer, doesn't it? I mean, 100 men and women dying is pretty bad, particularly if someone comes from your neighborhood or your town. A lot of these kids are from small towns. I say kids because they're 18 and 19 years old. Most of them figured, hey, I can get in there, get some training, because the economy is so bad in the United States, I'm not going to be able to afford college or industrial training, so I can get in the Army and get out. They didn't expect to be part of an expeditionary and occupation force in Iraq. So there's 2,000 soldiers have been wounded in Iraq since the war began in March, some of them quite severely. Of this number, 1,590 were wounded in hostile action, 337 from other causes. About 20% of the injured in Iraq have suffered severe brain injuries. Current injury statistics were easily obtained by editor and publisher through the U.S. Central Command, but they rarely appear in the daily newspapers. Because Bush says, he's complaining that the press... What he's complaining about is the press and the media is finally doing its job to some extent. You know, for months I called it the medium, not the media. Not, it wasn't many mediums. It was a single voice of government. It was essentially a Pravda or a Svestia, a unitary voice of power that didn't dare question, and you know, no more than a Soviet paper would question the party. Neither would this compliant press here. Now, when the war is over, when the damage is done, when there's thousands of Iraqi civilians dead, we learn this was all BS. It was all made up. It was all a construct. It was all a lie. Even now, says editor and publisher, when the injury information is easily available, many newspapers neglect to report or keep a tally, as an informal survey of some top papers has shown. Talk about how things have increased. As for the total deaths in Iraq, most of the media continues to only cite those killed in hostile action. On October 20th, for example, the New York Times reported, since President Bush declared an end to major hostilities in Iraq on May 1st, 106 American soldiers have been killed. And most of us are grieving at that. 106 soldiers killed. I was going to say young people, but when these reservists are getting killed, some of these people that are killed are in their 40s. Editor and publisher says, but this number represents only those killed in combat by hostile fire. A total of 200 American troops have been killed in this time period from all causes, such as vehicle accidents, drowning, and suicides. Suicides. There's been an extraordinary number of suicides by enlisted men in Iraq. So it's come to that. Now, this is the headline of the year. Army Reserve fears troop exodus. Retention is what I'm most worried about. It's my number one concern, says Lieutenant General James Helmley. He's chief of the Army Reserve, and he's worried that after this stint, that a lot of the Guard is not going to reenlist. Well, I wouldn't think so. And one more thing, and I want to get to your calls. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe. Now, if you were keeping close track of the news, Bush went over to Australia, and there's kind of a Bush light over there. John Howard, the Prime Minister of Australia, who sent some troops, and he was heckled. Bush was heckled in Canberra, Australia, whereas that's where the seat of government is, and Bush said, who can possibly think that the world would be better off with Saddam Hussein still in power? Well, okay, it's not good to have a man like that in power. Of course, the United States, and particularly Bush's father and Reagan, bear grave responsibility for placing Saddam Hussein in power and maintaining him in power. Thousands of anti-war demonstrators protested outside the building where Bush spoke, and two hecklers jeered him from within. Well, they were members of parliament. Anyways, here's what Bush said. Well, first off, the Australians were overwhelmingly opposed to their government participating in this war in Iraq. The Prime Minister, John Howard, sends them in any event. And so Bush is being heckled, and he says after it, isn't free speech grand? And smiles, and he gets kind of a laugh. Again, marginalizing the critics. And people participate in activities like heckling or even demonstrating when they're shut out of the larger political discourse of a country. And it loses its ability to describe itself as a democratic nation. Because you have the voices of power, the voices of war, the voices of authority, the voices of the ruler occupying about 97% of the available public space allowed for discourse. And when you do get out there, when people from all over the country come to Washington, come to San Francisco and a number of other cities in the United States. Well, the New York Times, then, they spend a lot of time after they say that the demonstration borrowed heavily from the imagery of the 1960s peace protests over Vietnam, then spends all this time giving the Bush side of things. Now, why every time they report on what the Bush administration says, why isn't there this similar space given to what the critics say? Well, because if they did, this house of cards that Bush is running would collapse. Now, listen to what Bush says to the Australian Parliament. America, Australia, and other nations acted in Iraq to remove a grave and gathering danger instead of wishing and waiting till a tragedy drew closer. Now, before I've said this was a Hitlerian lie, what that means is, I wasn't so much comparing Bush to Hitler and you know, in the larger sense, but rather this was part of the Nazi strategy towards making people believe things that aren't true. If you repeat things enough and have the official trappings cloak them, people begin to believe them. Because I don't think too many people, even people that were opposed to this war and opposed to the occupation, immediately react to this. America, Australia, and other nations acted in Iraq to remove a grave and gathering danger. Well, there was no grave danger at all. Zero. None. Nada. Not a damn thing. This was a lie that was made up intentionally to take Bush two places. One, back into high popularity, because we know his, you know, before he invented this lie, that his ratings were sinking, and also to act out the long-standing plans to do this. Remember now, we know that in as early as March of 2002, the United States government was already preparing for the invasion and occupation of Iraq, before they, quote, knew that there was any danger, any grave and gathering danger, as Bush lies. You notice, too, people are beginning to call Bush a liar, saying he lies, not misrepresent, not selectively taking intelligence and what have you, but lies. I don't know why it's so hard for people to get that out of their mouth about Bush. Didn't have any problem with, you know, with Clinton. Maybe not, because it was kind of an insignificant act that he was accused of. Whereas this is extraordinarily significant. One of the signs in popular bumper sticker now is, Bush lied, people died. Or, when Clinton lied, no one died. So there's a whole difference there. By the way, this demonstration that took place in Washington yesterday that my wife and I and tens of thousands of others were at was led by the Military Families and Veterans Contingent. The families of active duty occupation troops, ones that are in Iraq right now, the military families and also veterans from all the other wars, including the Gulf War and Vietnam and Panama and what have you. They led the tens of thousands that apparently borrowed heavily from the imagery of the 1960s peace protests over Vietnam, which to some extent is true. During the Vietnam War, all the demonstrations were led by active duty GIs. So this lie about, you know, the anti-war movement in the 1960s being hostile to the GIs, spitting on them all, that was just a big lie, a load of crap. Another one of these things that have just been said so many times that people believe it. All right, I had another subject as well. Oh, yeah, just one other thing. I was talking about the numbers and all that. One thing I really found absolutely offensive was the Washington police. Now, the demonstration was made up of almost exclusively nonviolent, peaceful people. Yet all along the route, the buildings were protected, if you will, by men and women, police, park guards, and what have you, who were looking like they were ready for battle, with 3-foot riot staves, helmets with shields in their face, gas masks at their side, ready for war almost. And the message that it portrays to the public, these are dangerous people. These are people that aren't authentic. These are people that are marginal. These are exotic people that could explode into violence at any moment. So we have to station police armed to the teeth. And what was the message there? That if you stepped out of line at all with these 3-foot riot staves, that these robocops were going to wade into the crowd and start bashing heads of middle-class, middle-aged people and young college students and children in strollers? Now, I got to tell you, in terms of how they're, you know, it sounds like I'm angry at the individual cops. No police officer ever goes anywhere on his own. He's assigned. And it's not like they decide, hey, how are you going to dress today, Al? Well, I'm going to wear short sleeves. What are you going to wear? Oh, I'm going to wear full battle dress. They're instructed to dress in the manner that they are. And so this is done for heavy political reasons. This is the image. In fact, I heard an interview with the head cop beforehand, before the march on Friday night. And he was saying, we respect the right of people to exercise their First Amendment rights, but if anyone gets out of hand, well, I mean, what's this? Yeah? And I guess at the tail end, about 6 o'clock, thing began at 1, a bunch of kids in masks began, whoa, here's a crime, spray painting a wooden fence. So there was a little go-around with them, you know, cops chasing them. But certainly this, you know, they were over, how can I put it? It was inappropriately garbed. Inappropriately garbed from the crowd that essentially was high-spirited in the best sense of the word, and even sort of joyous. Because when you're marginalized, like the tens of millions of people in America and the hundreds of millions of people around the world, from expressing your opinions through authentic political discourse in a democratic society, when you're not allowed to do that, and the only place you can do that is in the streets, well, when you all come together, it is pretty joyous. All right, let's hear from you. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and Rick Fox is our producer and phone screener. You will talk to him when you call that number. Hi, this is Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
How you doing?
Hey, doing good.
I want to make a couple points. You made a good comment on the retention. I did 5 years active duty, and then I did 3 years as a reservist, and I got out. And I think you're a fool if you don't get out now. The first chance you get out of there. Because everything that this country is doing right now is totally out of line. All the friends that I have that are still in, that are overseas, they're down in Guantanamo Bay and everything else, they don't agree with what's going on. And the other point that you made with the police officers, and it's actually kind of funny because now I'm a police officer,
mm-hmm.
and they, you got people. Peaceful protesters out there, and they want to, and it all comes down with what you're talking about with the media and everything else. They're agreeing and not making any kind of protest when it comes to you know, the Clinton administration or the Bush administration and everything else. I just think it's just absolutely ridiculous, but I wanted to make that comment on the retention.
Well, yeah, I think after what these guys have experienced, I don't think there's going to be too many of them going back. You know, in the New York Times is one of the few papers that actually lists the battle deaths in Iraq, and you see some of these ages, 18 and 19, just like in Vietnam, but then you see like 42 years old, 43 years old.
Well, there's a lot of reservists that are at that age because they're trying to get their retirement, and they're coming up to their 20 years, and they want to just get their retirement, and then boom, they get shipped off here, and they've got children, and well, they leave their wives that are pregnant, that have jobs back here, and families, and then all of a sudden, what was the stat on how many people committed suicide? Because I just heard that the other day, and it was astronomical.
I can't remember, and I don't want to say I'm fearful of exaggerating it either way. Someone may remind us, though, but it was rather startling that...
It shocked me, I know that.
Yeah.
When I heard it, I took a step back, and I said, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, and, you know...
The morale must absolutely be through the basement.
Yeah, that's what most of the men say that have spoken at all, and certainly now when you're starting to get these... these families. I'm trying to think of the name of the group. It's something like military. If you go to my website and you want to link on to some of these veterans groups or active military families, it's at peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. And if you go down a bit, because, you know, and then you have Bush, they're cutting all these benefits for the veterans. And did you see that story of at Fort Stewart in Georgia, what had happened to these wounded? These guys are in these cement barracks with no air conditioning. You know, then it was like when this story was about 2 weeks ago, it was very hot. They weren't getting the kind of medical care. Now, all of a sudden, you know, one of the generals saying, oh, you know, this has been a mistake. And there's all these guys that have suffered these catastrophic injuries that have just been kept out of sight.
Well, you know what? The benefits for the retirees are the benefits that are really, really lacking now. I mean, when I was active duty, I received pretty good benefits and everything like that. But I've talked to some retirees recently, and they've been telling me that basically the benefits are non-existent. I mean, to get any kind of services now that you're retired,
mm-hmm.
It's over.
Well, I want to thank you for giving your opinion.
All right, Peter.
I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. If you want to, by the way, contact me by email. And hopefully we're streaming all over the country, all over the world at WRIF.com. You can also go to nightcall@WRIF.com. Not go to it, but that's my email address. Let's see. From Billy Pilgrim. Thanks to the White Rose Society. Yeah, if you go to whiteRoseSociety.com, or is it, geez, you know, I'm sorry, let me see, is it, okay. I should have, you know, I'm going to read this through first. This has got a lot of elements to it. In fact, why don't we do this? Why don't we take our first break right now, and we'll get to our next call right after that.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this. Only the best live local bands that the Motor City has to offer are on stage for you Sunday nights at the Hot Rock in Warren. Join Scream and Scott Randall from 101 WRIF tonight for the most outrageous Sunday night party in Metro Detroit, only at the Hot Rock Cafe.
Get yourself a little rock and roll ear candy with the Motor City's very own Breakpoint, then take in a feast for the eyes with the Hot Rock's Hot Bod Contest. Pick up on killer riff giveaways, plus the first 101 people through the door will score a pair of tickets to see 7 Mary 3 on November 1st.
Knock back great $2 bottle beers and get your hands on the Hot Rocks awesome shot specials all throughout the night. Don't forget, it's happening tonight with The Riff. Come on out and party with The Riff's Scott Randall and hear live local rock from Breakpoint. It's all going down at the Hot Rock Cafe.
The Hot Rock Cafe on Hoover Road just south of 10 Mile and Warren.
Sunday night's rock at the Hot Rock Cafe.
You're on your way to a better day when you think Ford first.
Think Ford Escape for a fun-to-drive, safe-to-drive compact sport utility. Escape is a great value and is loaded with equipment to adapt to your lifestyle. Current ACD plan lessees can lease a 2004 Escape XLT for only $178 a month with $2973 due at signing. Only $178 a month with a V6, automatic, four-wheel ABS, power moonroof, and much more.
Think Ford first.
A well-equipped 2004 Escape XLT for only $178 a month for 24 months through Ford Credit, with $2973 due at signing, excluding title and taxes, and at a matching down payment and cash back. This $178 payment includes a $500 renewal bonus if you currently lease a Ford Division product and lease a new one and take retail delivery from dealer stock by 12-103. Some payments higher, some lower. Not all lessees will qualify. Residency restrictions apply.
You Metro Detroit Ford dealers.
Looking for luxury living in a price range that's the same as your rent payment? Stop looking, because now you can afford to buy a new condo in one of Canton's most exciting new communities, The Links at Fellows Creek from Robertson Brothers. Come home to your very own retreat, surrounded by the beautiful Fellows Creek Golf Course. You'll enjoy pastoral park areas featuring a complete walkway system, access to our private clubhouse and pool, and more. These condominiums feature a choice of three ranch-style floor plans, ranging in size from 12 to over 1,500 square feet. Plus, this premier community is located near major expressways and Plymouth Canton schools. Priced in the high 150s, you'll find peace of mind and peace and quiet at The Links at Fellows Creek. We've been so busy selling, we haven't had time for a grand opening. So if you're tired of renting and want more from where you live, visit the Links at Fellows Creek on the southwest corner of Lots and Palmer Roads in Canton. Or call 734-728-2354.
Man, how'd you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of legendary stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make love as long as you want with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Sex is good. Sex with Maxtral is incredible. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Things that go bump in the night.
Horrific extravagancy
and horrifying reality.
The ultimate Halloween event returned.
Haunt
Fest. Halloween's ultimate Hallapalooza. With more thrills, more chills,
more horror.
Every weekend in October, beginning October 10th, Meadowbrook Music Festival on the campus of Oakland University.
Experience the Monster Midway.
The state-of-the-art haunted house.
So scary you'll wet yourself.
Festival foods and more. Every weekend in October, beginning October 10th at Meadowbrook Music Festival. The campus of Oakland University is transformed into Haunted Fest. Haunted House Hotline gave it 4.75 out of 5 stars. The school calls it the best haunted attraction ever.
Haunted Fest.
Doors open nightly at 7. Every weekend in October, beginning October 10th at Meadowbrook Music Festival. Get tickets at the door, palacenet.com, the Palace box office, and all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge by phone, 248-645-6666.
On Fest. Be there if you dare.
I don't want to just read the book. I want to write the book.
I don't want to just work for the company. I want to own the company.
I don't want to just live in the building. I want to design the building.
If you think big.
I don't want to drive a sports car. Well, I do.
Or dream big.
I want to engineer one.
We want you at University of Detroit Mercy. And together, we'll make great things happen for you. Choose from architecture, engineering, communications, chemistry, psychology, pre-law, over 100 respected UDM programs and degrees, and make your dreams of a rewarding future come true. Call 1-800-635-5020 or visit www.udmercy.edu.
I don't want to just hope for the cure. I want to discover the cure.
University of Detroit Mercy. We want great things for you.
Call UDM today to reserve your spot at an upcoming visit day. Financial aid and scholarships are available for qualified students. Call Nancy at 1-800-635-5020.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. And I finally figured out the email. It wasn't too hard that I had gotten from Billy Pilgrim. Billy Pilgrim runs globalfreepress.com. Globalfreepress.com, a great site. It also archives this show and also the old Peter Werby show. If you don't know what that is, go to it's globalfreepress.org. Globalfreepress.org. Actually, I see what it is as well. You can go to news.globalfreepress.com, but start with globalfreepress.org. Also, whiterosesociety.org also archives this show. And if you go to my website, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E, it's peterwerby.com. All sorts of good things on there. A little preview of the MC5, you know, Detroit's seminal rock band. It's going to see the film, MC5, A True Testimonial, is going to be at the Detroit Institute of Arts this Thursday, October 30th. And we'll be running an interview with the producer at 1 a.m. tonight. Lots of other stuff as well. Let's see, you know, you've heard all these, another one of the big lies by Bush. about sex tourism in Cuba. You can read an interesting article by someone who has been there repeatedly. Sex tourism in Cuba, real or another Bush lie. All of that at peterwerby.com. All right, let's go to your calls. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, this is Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Megadero, Peter.
Well, thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Even though you're never away that long.
Right. I just...
You kind of take care of business real fast.
Yes, I do. Well,
anyway.
What are you talking about? I was just off to Washington, the big anti-war, anti-occupation, anti-Bush demonstration that occurred in Washington, D.C. We don't know how many people were there. Tens of thousands, they say.
Well, it just seems awful funny that, we have millions and millions of people that are fed up with the Bush administration. But yet, you listen to the news media, and they say, oh, no, that's very few.
Right.
No, they're lying to us.
They don't even say that. They actually give the impression that that's a little more insidious, actually.
I want to bring up something more local around here. I bet
sure.
It's all right.
Sure, sure.
The job situations today. I had to retire on a disability. I put almost 30 years in with the city of Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Now... the guy he was a director over there of the Public Works Department. He's going to get himself a job with Pontiac now.
Okay.
All right. And in the meantime, these cities say they can't afford to hire anybody, and yet he's going to Pontiac and he's going to take the Public Works director's job over there. In other words, he's retiring from Berkeley and he's going to Pontiac to build himself up another pension. And at the same time, they say they can't afford to hire any full-time people, that run the place, that work at the place. They just hire all these directors. I don't get it. Now, all these chiefs and no Indians is...
Well, I know.
Something's goofy with our economy.
Well, there is, because there is obviously cutbacks everywhere as states and counties and municipalities struggle to get a balanced budget. The money's just not here. The money, our tax dollars, are flying off to... Halliburton and all these companies, Friends of Bush's, that first destroy Iraq for billions of dollars and then get paid to rebuild it. So it's sort of a nice circular little racket there. Where was I? I was trying to remember something I heard tonight on these debates. I'll try to get this back in my memory. The debates of the Democratic Party candidates were in Detroit. All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Hi, this is Night Call, and you're on the air.
Yes, I know you were talking about all the reserves that are over there, but I think, and the families, a lot of people don't understand. Like my sister, her husband has been over there for 10 months now.
Boy.
And left a good-paying job because that was his duty. And they don't realize they do not get the pay that they got when they were employed.
Oh, of course not.
My sister is living on half of what they used to get. They lost their home. They're living with my parents. She gets not even $1,300 a month to live on.
Yes.
And I just think that is appalling. But they're over there doing what they're supposed to be doing and forgetting the families here who are now below poverty level.
Well, that's interesting because it's the same thing I was just talking to the last caller. Same thing. There was a quote here. Let me see. Where was that from? Somewhere from Bush where he said, let me see if I can find it real quickly. Well, I can't find it right now, but it was you wonder what's happening in this country. Where is our money being spent? What's happening to us taking care of our citizens, our cities? That seems to be now like an afterthought.
About making sure that the other people over there have food and electricity and this and that. My sister has never in her life went to ADC office. She's living on food stamps. Well, her husband is fighting for our country.
Here's what George W. Bush said October 11th of this year. Saddam Hussein built up a massive war machine while neglecting the basic needs of his own people.
Huh. I mean, isn't that kind of what Hussein did?
I mean, isn't that kind of what Bush is doing? That's
he's living in this big white house and taking everything from us.
There you go. Well, hopefully, if enough people speak their mind, and hopefully we get George W. Bush out of there, send him back to Crawford, Texas, or Connecticut, or wherever he's from, things will improve. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, we're beginning to hear, this whole thing has turned out to be a tragedy for everyone, for the Iraqis, yeah, for our people.
And I'm just wondering when the first person who realizes that, George Bush went into this and lied and tricked his way, how many people get up and sue him for unlawful death?
There you go. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Wow. Yeah, that's what George W. Bush said, October 11, 2003. Saddam Hussein built up a massive war machine while neglecting the basic needs of his own people. Here's the wealthiest country in the world with millions of homeless, tens of millions of people beneath the poverty line, while the United States spends hundreds of billions of dollars for war and occupation and rebuilding the destruction that George Bush created. Right. Let me see. We've got another call here. Mr. Fox, thank you. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. This is Dan from Livonia.
Hi, Dan.
Welcome back to Michigan. I'm very grateful that you're back. I grew up in Ann Arbor.
Well, I got to say, I was only gone Tuesday through about 3 hours ago, so.
Yeah, we missed you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I just moved to Livonia recently, and I'm telling you, if they had a demonstration here like that, we'd probably be seeing the same thing like you did with the Washington police. They're probably just waiting for another Kent State situation back in 1970. That's our homeland security for you, though. Going against the American people and not for and working for them.
Well, I would hope. And in fairness, I mean, the police didn't do anything. It wasn't that in Washington. But I was saying that just the manner in which they present the risk. And that's what's typified things in this country for, it goes back before September 11th in terms of how the government responded to people that had the temerity to get out in the street and demonstrate, presenting them always like a potential, threat, just, ready to explode.
Yeah.
I mean, and this came about because there were some windows broken in Seattle. And there were windows broken in Seattle by a handful of people. This is, I'm talking about 1999 at the World Trade Organization. The vast majority of people that participated in that, all the trade unionists, all the environmentalists, all the college students, again, the tens of thousands, they were peaceful and nonviolent. It was mostly the Seattle police that were the violent ones.
Yep. I do have a question that maybe you can give me a little clarity on.
Sure, Dan.
I was reading on the Friday's paper, the Detroit Free Press, about the, you just mentioned about the Cuban travel, about Cuba. It's kind of funny that, 40 years ago we created this embargo to get Fidel Castro out of power, which, by the way, never did happen.
Didn't work, did it?
Sure didn't. And it kind of really boggles me that, Bush spend billions and billions of dollars for the destruction of countries, and while the American people are being destructed by him. He just said on October 9th that we need to get, I'm trying to read the quote here, we need to have more strict and more firm laws against the travel ban for America. It kind of makes me laugh that here Bush wants to fight against terrorism. And either you're with us or against us. So he doesn't use that quote anymore because I guess we'd be at war with the world. Here, he doesn't want any of the Americans to go to Cuba because I guess the real terrorists do live in Cuba. But at the same time, there is no travel ban with North Korea. Now,
you can just go off to Pyongyang if you want.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Bush is always pimping for votes. And in this case, he wants to sidle up to these right-wing Cubans in Miami. Now, both the House and the Senate have voted to repeal this travel ban because ultimately it ain't about politics. It's about selling, wheat and other things. And so these Republicans have actually been in the forefront of trying to repeal this travel ban, and they've put it in this larger bill that Bush may be forced to veto. So this is going to be very interesting. His party, or at least enough of them, to pass this bill have gone against what he wants and put him in an extraordinarily embarrassing position, which I think is just wonderful.
Yep. Well, thank you. Thank you. I just need a little clarity on that.
All right, Dan, thank you. And you might be interested if you go to my website and seeing that story about a friend of mine. Bush, shouldn't say that. Someone who sent me a story of his travels in Cuba.
Yep, I'll be definitely interested to read that.
All right, thank you so much. You can go to peterwerbe.com. That's W-E-R-B-E.com. Joe is listening in Frankfort, Connecticut. And he says, and I'm not reading this, lack of medical care to injured Iraq war veterans. He says, have you seen this? Wonder how many are from what states or what towns and cities. Delayed care and charging $10 a day for more comfortable hospital accommodations. What in the hell is going on? Is this a rollover attitude from big corporate types? You know, we give ourselves outlandishly high salary and perks. Let the workers go buy the best they can. Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and their boss get the best of everything, but the citizen sloggers and grunts and swabbies and get bunk beds and outhouses because these, oh yeah, that's right, these wounded Iraqi casualties, the American casualties from Iraq, they in these facilities, they had an outhouse. They had to, like, take, their, what do you call those things, their IVs, and go to these outhouses. Joe says he's a former lieutenant, U.S. NR, what is that, Naval Reserve? Vietnam era, must be. And this can't be the sacrifices that the president called for, can it? Much hell and much publicity needs to be raised about this, if true. And it appears to be a legitimate story. It is, indeed. You can go to TomPaine.com. It's called The Pentagon's Achilles Heel. Go to it's P-A-I-N-E, the Great American Patriot, TomPaine.com, and you can see that story. It's called The Pentagon's Achilles Heel. All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Hey, you with me? You're not. Okay. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, this is Scott from Westland.
Well, hi, Scott.
Actually, I've got some good news, and I think that this has been largely overlooked, I think, or ignored since it happened by the so-called liberal media or media at large. Did anybody notice that the Supreme Court actually upheld California's medical marijuana law?
Well, they didn't uphold it. They said they weren't going to review it, which was about the same thing as upheld. I mean, in other words, they didn't vote. So they told John Ashcroft to get out of the medical business and stop trying to threaten doctors that prescribe marijuana for sick and dying patients.
Well, no, it's interesting because before this happened, I would have said that sarcastically about, you know, the situation in California, that if Arnold Schwarzenegger wanted to, in the short, near term, you know, jumpstart the California economy, well, he should legalize marijuana. But now, apparently, the Supreme Court, decision has opened the door for that to be a new industry in California. And they have, like, a, you know, year-round growing season in many parts of California, so it's like they can start tomorrow.
There you go.
So I have to admit, I'm pretty amused by this. I'm just curious. Did you ever see the movie Pumping Iron with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
No, I never saw it.
Oh well, this was even on public television. So again, it's amazing, this liberal media that nobody made more of this. If you wanted to see, Arnold Schwarzenegger, in sort of a compromising situation in this movie, which I think was nominated for Academy Award, I think Barbara Copple's Harlan County, USA won in that year, 76, but this was actually nominated for an Academy Award. This documentary, Pumping Iron, you actually see Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lou Ferrigno, the original TV Hulk, with Bill Bixby and all that stuff. So Lou Ferrigno and Arnold Schwarzenegger on camera smoke a joint.
Oh, and Arnold making fun of Lou, right? I remembered what I was getting at. They were talking about. You heard about this general that was appearing at these right wing religious revival meetings in full battle dress, talking about how God selected George W. Bush. He said, this is really weird. I'm watching this film of this guy, this general, who's up in the Defense Department in charge of, I think, tracking down, like, remember Osama bin Forgotten and those kind of folks. Anyway, so he's there saying, now you people realize that the majority of people did not vote for George W. Bush. I'm going, whoa, wait a minute. Usually these right-wingers don't like to admit this. Okay, yeah, because George W. Bush lost the popular election. The majority of people in the United States who voted in 2000 did not want George Bush to be the president. So he asked rhetorically, the general does, why then is George W. Bush in the White House? And why? Because God wanted him there. And then he talks about this being a, you know, that he shows pictures of Osama bin Laden, and he said, this is not our enemy. And he shows a picture of Saddam Hussein, and he says, this is not our enemy. And which probably is why he can't catch them. But he said, here is a picture of our enemy, and it is Satan. So you have right-wing nutballs in the highest echelons of the U.S. government. This is a government that, on one hand, is right-wing fanatics and religious fanatics. This is not a good combination, folks, at all. And Scott, also, I remember, too, is that during the Democratic candidates' debate tonight in Detroit, John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, said, when he was commenting on this, and he said that the guy kept talking about the Almighty, which he said really confused people in Washington, because when Bush hears all of them talking about the Almighty, he thinks they mean Cheney. And when Cheney hears talk about the Almighty, he thinks they mean Halliburton. And when they all hear Almighty, they think they're talking about John Ashcroft. That was a good line from Kerry. Thank you, Scott. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe. And here's our next caller. Thanks for joining us here on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Hey, I just want to bring up a point I think everybody's missing, and I'm not going to get into what administration did what and didn't. But before, we had an administration that was totally reactive to everything terrorist. Then that brought us the coal incident, the embassy bombing in Africa, the first trade center, and all we did was react, and it didn't get us anywhere. Now we've got an administration that's being proactive, going out, seeking out terrorism, and its home front. And
it's
unpopular. It's unpopular,
and
it's dirty.
You got all these assumptions that don't bear up when you expose them to reality. There's no one, Bush about 3 weeks ago said there is nothing to connect Saddam Hussein with September 11th, and there is no connection between Saddam Hussein and any terrorists. He made this all up. He made everything up so he could invade Iraq. There's no connection to terrorism. He had no weapons. He had no intention to create weapons. He probably, if we would have let the inspections go on, it could very possibly have created the downfall of his government. So this is not proactive. This is an illegal invasion, a crime against peace based on a lie.
Okay. Now, I know a lot of Chaldeans that are from Iraq. And the atrocities that were perpetrated in that country alone by his family were enough for us to go in. Uday used to
Wait. These were some very, very horrible people. The United States has an unfortunate long history of supporting terror states. Like, we're pumping money now into Colombia, which then, this goes to, some of the money goes to these right-wing terror groups, these militias that carry out massacres in Colombian villages. The United States overthrew governments in Guatemala and kept dictators in Nicaragua and places like that. So to all of a sudden to be horrified by what our client state does, and you have to remember the reason that Saddam Hussein was in power was because Bush's father and Reagan supported him, gave him money, gave him intelligence in his war against Iraq. And Rumsfeld went over and shook the hand of Saddam Hussein in the late 1980s after he had used poison gas both against the Iranians and the Kurds in the north. Now, if the United States went around the world and started invading every single country that committed atrocities, we would have troops probably in about 30 or 40 countries. The reason that they went in there is to grab the oil and to boost Bush's popularity. There's nothing to do with these men who support other dictatorships, like the dictatorship of Pakistan, the military dictatorship that overthrew the elected government there. So you're believing nonsense, I'm sorry to say bluntly.
Well, I just think we're being proactive.
Well, I know you say we're being proactive, but we're being proactive. Why didn't, you know, there were inspections going on. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There is no connection between Saddam Hussein's government and terrorism. So it's not being proactive. The United States should have invaded Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a terrible dictatorship that punishes people within its borders very badly. It's an authoritarian, religious dictatorship. And if you do remember, most of they've misidentified a lot of the people. The majority of people on that on those 9/11 planes were from Saudi Arabia. But they're our buddies. We love them. We go over there, and they invite them to all these big confabs and what have you. Come on, man. They're playing you for a sucker.
No. I really believe? I believe he had poor intelligence from the beginning. But, you know, his administration was like, come on, this guy's got to have weapons of mass destruction. He's got to have it. So we go in, and you've got a 99% probability we're going to find this stuff.
Wait. Yeah. See, there you go. From when this first was put together, I said, he has no weapons of mass destruction. They know they have no weapons of mass destruction. There was enough evidence at the beginning to know that this was constructed purposefully to fool the American people. Colin Powell lied in the United Nations when he showed all these photographs and he said they got 500 tons of these deadly poisons. When Bush said that they've got these ships circling the world that could launch at us at any moment. They didn't believe for a second there was a weapon of mass destruction. If they had believed that, they wouldn't have sent the troops in. I mean, it's a flat out lie.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
If you're looking for a new timepiece, One Jewelry Store has a selection of fine Swiss watches unlike any other jewelry store. There's a special feeling that comes from wearing a finely crafted Swiss timepiece. And Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, has a vast selection of the latest styles from the world's top watchmakers, like Omega, Tag Heuer, Movado, Tissot, and more. Plus, Jared has incredibly low prices every day. Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, is the place to shop if you're looking for an outstanding assortment of fine Swiss timepieces. Come in today to see the new Omega Men's Constellation line, the new Tag Heuer Tiger Woods chronograph, the classic Movado Museum Collection, or the amazing Tissot D touchscreen watch. All at Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry. Jared, located at the corner of M59 and the Van Dyke Expressway, on Baldwin Road in Auburn Hills, and on Novi Road across from the 12 Oaks Mall.
Okay. Two blades are better than one, and three blades are better than two. And that's as good as it gets, right? Wrong. The new Schick Quattro has the power of four blades and two conditioning strips, which makes Quattro unlike any other razor. And those four blades give you an incredibly close, smooth shave. So your 5 o'clock shadow shows up late. Four blades? Where will it stop? Here with Schick Quattro. The power of four.
And when you stop in at CVS Pharmacy, you'll find Schick Quattro razors in the health and beauty aisle. Your neighborhood CVS has everything you need to look and feel your best. From Schick Quattro razors that give you an incredibly close, smooth shave, to CVS shaving cream. And for super savings, always use your CVS Extra Care card. It's the best way to shop and the best way to save every day. So stop by CVS and pick up Schick Quattro for an incredibly close, smooth shave. Available now at CVS Pharmacy.
It's Taco Bell's Zesty Chicken Bowl. We don't prepare it until you say, give me a Zesty Chicken Bowl.
Somebody say a Zesty Chicken Bowl? Coming right up.
Hey, pal, we're making a commercial here.
Yeah, and I'm fixing your Zesty Chicken Bowl. Will you scoot over?
Okay.
How about a little narration, Mr. Pro Voice Guy?
Oh, right. Grilled all-white meat chicken.
You know it. Now for the rice.
Warm seasoned rice.
Not just any cheese, but...
but a delicate blend of three melted cheeses.
Now you're talking. Lettuce.
Crisp lettuce.
And finally, salsa.
Freshly prepared fiesta salsa.
Say it, don't spray it.
Oh, sorry. Taco Bell's Zesty Chicken Bowl. Made right when you order it so it tastes even better. For fresh made taste, think outside the bun.
At participating locations.
Nice.
When it's late and you're hungry, listen to the little voice in your head.
Taco Bell is open late.
Spice up the night. Think outside the bun.
Open till 1 a.m. or later. Hours may vary by location.
Buying a home? Tired of wasting your valuable time scouring the newspapers and home magazines? Want to search thousands of homes for sale in one spot? Then you need HomeQuarters at HQRealEstate.com. Every available listing in Southeast Michigan is just a click away. Detailed information, photos, search tools, and property alerts, so you'll be the first to know when your perfect home becomes available. HomeQuarters is powered by local real estate professionals. Just go to HQRealEstate.com. HomeQuarters. Your next move starts here. Selling your home? Want more buyers to know your home is for sale?
Want to save money too?
Then you need HomeQuarters. More buyers will see your home when you list with HomeQuarters. HomeQuarters is powered by local real estate professionals, and our low commissions will save you thousands of dollars. Maximum exposure,
maximum savings.
Go to HQRealEstate.com or call right now, 888-615-9995. That's 888-615-9995. HomeQuarters. Your next move starts here.
Attention homeowners, 3.99. You heard it right, 3.99%. American Equity Mortgage has just lowered interest rates. Effective immediately, American Equity is offering you a never-before-advertised 3.99 rate. This is for a very limited time only, so I urge you to call now. American Equity Mortgage guarantees to save you money at 3.99, and American Equity Mortgage will help you pay off all those 18% credit cards that have proven to cost you money every month. You gotta love it at 3.99. Can you believe it? You know it won't last too long. American Equity Mortgage makes it fast and easy. 3.99. Call now. 888-71-LOAN-1. 888-71-LOAN. Then the number one. American Equity Mortgage. The future belongs to you. 3.99 can't last too long. Call now. 888-71-LOAN-1. 888-71-LOAN. Then the number one.
Rate subject to change. APR 4.189. Rate subject to increase after consummation.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. You can also write me at nightcall@wrif.com. Website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. This is WRIF Detroit. Let's see here. No name on this one, but it says, hey, Pete, love the show. In case you don't know, Michael Moore will be speaking at the Eastern Michigan University Convocation Center this Friday, October 31st at 7 p.m., wondering if you will be there. First I'd heard of it. Michael Moore, brand new book called Dude, Where's My Country? Number one bestseller this week on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's going to blow away all those... You know, all those right-wingers, they sell these books, and then their pals buy them up in carloads to kind of get them on the list. And you were talking about tens of thousands there. The printing, the first printing of Michael Moore's brand-new book, Dude, Where's My Country, is... did he take that from Dude, Where's My Car? Probably. That silly-ass film. Anyway, they've printed a million, first printing of a million of his book, and his hardcover from last year, Stupid White Men and Other Sorry Excuses for the State of the Union, that is still like in the top 30 best-selling books, and they keep saying they're going to put it into paper, and still, you know, the book keeps selling in hardcover, and you know how, you know, those book companies are, they're not going to... They're not going to put it into the cheaper model until people stop buying the hardcover. All right, let's go back and get some of your calls. Hi, WRIF, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hello. Whoop, wait a minute, hold on. Hello, there you go. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, who's this?
This is Kim.
Kim, hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I was just wondering about the fact that why would we be going over there in Iraq as troops looking for
weapons of mass destruction, yeah.
Thank you very much. Anyways, when the UN was over there for 2 years and they couldn't find anything.
Well, that's exactly the point. I'll tell you, Kim, the reason that, one of the reasons that Bush invaded as quickly as he did, that he realized that soon enough, the United Nations would say, well, we looked all around here and they don't have anything.
Yeah, but they do. There's thousands and thousands of acres of land in there with sand. And what happens if they have it underground?
Well, there's no reason to suspect that they do have them. I mean, every piece of evidence prior to the, you know, before Bush started making up all these lies pointed to the fact that, in fact, that they had ended all their programs as, because we got to remember, the UN inspectors were in there for like 7 years and they supervised all this destruction of these development programs and weapons themselves. And also, you know, the United States has all this satellite technology. If they actually had any weapons, they would have been able to see them from space.
Yeah, I agree with that. But why did they find that mound there with the sand that had, you know, what's the word?
Hidden?
Undercover.
Undercover, hidden? I don't know. I mean, they haven't found anything that qualifies in terms of what the Bush administration had said already. Look, there's a guy, pardon me, whose name is Greg Thielman, and he was the director of the Office of Strategic Proliferation and Military Affairs. Man, that's harder to say than weapons of mass destruction.
Thank you.
Yeah, and in other words, what he did was he was an expert on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. He'd been a Foreign Service officer for 25 years, and here's what he said. At the time of Powell's speech, this is Colin Powell, when Powell went to the United Nations and said, oh, we're really in danger. He says that Iraq did not pose an imminent threat to anyone. He says, I don't think it didn't even constitute an imminent threat to its neighbors at the time of war. So here is, you know, a career officer in our government that says essentially Bush, Powell, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and the rest of them were lying. They completely made all of this up. And I was saying this since last September because, and you know, I'm not such a bright guy. I don't have any more sources of information than you do. But, Kim, it was available, and it was a matter of whether you were willing to take the Bush administration on the face of what it said. And the entire media did. And they presented almost everything that Bush and the rest of them said uncritically. There was this enormous anti-war movement that said all along, there are no weapons of mass destruction. Bush is lying. And they were just marginalized. The people wouldn't listen to them. They said, oh, they're just a bunch of demonstrators and protesters and stuff like that. But it turned out we were right. Bush lied. And it's not just a matter of somebody like, Clinton saying, I did not have sex with that woman. You know, and everybody's looking at him and saying, come on, Clinton, you are lying. We know it. What happened here is that thousands of people now have died. A country has been destroyed, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel.
You know what? Yeah, you're right about that. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. But you have to think about the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people were abused. Even the Olympic people were abused. Somebody who abuses people who play for their country to give them pride and dignity, and for them to turn around and to abuse them.
Well, no,
why would they have mass destruction?
Well, Kim, they're pretty terrible, but you don't invade a country. I mean, that's why there's the United Nations, and the very possible that if the United States had been more patient and understood that the authority of Saddam Hussein, this absolute authority that he wielded over Iraqi society was beginning to erode because for all practical purposes that the country was occupied by the United Nations. And these inspectors who had the authority to go everywhere. And there's been other absolute dictatorships. And I'm thinking about this one that was in Romania, this guy Ceausescu. He was all-powerful one day and poof, just dead the next day. The people turned on him. And hopefully that was something that could have occurred. I mean, you don't, what we talk about is the desire to have a world run by international law. And the supervisory body, mostly United States allies, said, come on, we got to give the United Nations inspectors more of a chance. France, who got so reviled, everybody's saying, you know, oh, these cheese eaters and all that. They said, hey, how about another 30 days? And Bush said, no, we can't wait another 30 days because Iraq might attack us. I mean, which was so preposterous that it defies the imagination, particularly when we look back on it. So now, because Americans are good people, and people like yourself, Kim, you're looking at what an awful, terrible government Iraq was. Well, it was. It was awful. It was terrible. It did some of the most hideous things, some of which you told us about. But it doesn't mean that one country, because it has the ability to do it, can just go in and wipe out 7,000 Iraqi civilians, wind up with the United States having, you know, maybe close to 2,500 casualties now, because George Bush says that's what he wants to do. All right, I got to move on. Kim, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Oh, hi, Peter. It's Terry from Dearborn.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. You've mentioned the new voting machines with the touch tone, whatever, no
touch
paper
screen.
Trail machines.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to expand a little bit on that. Now, if I were to title my comments there, I would say, do we have a brave new world to look forward to? I say we have scary new voting machines to
yeah.
look forward to. I say scary because we've already seen the presidency stolen by Bush right before our eyes, which, by the way, is a coup, because a coup is defined as any illegal seizure of power, and it doesn't have to be by military force. Now, in the case of 2000, it was a combined force of the Supreme Court, the mass media, or medium, and, of course, the Democrats' unwillingness to allow it without much of any fight. Anyway, the main point, and this cannot ever be overstated because it's such an obvious, blatant, and just too easy to be ignored way for Republicans and corporate interests to steal the elections in the future. I'm referring to, you know, computer voting machines. Now, from what we've seen...
Owned by Republicans, and that's what's frightening the people. I think the book is called Black Box Voting. Black Box Voting, and it is... You could probably go to Google or some search engine and just put in Black Box Voting, but I know that the book is actually online. You can get it...
because from what I've read, we're looking at... this city can steal a race without even lifting a finger because from what I've heard is that the computer software used to count and tally all the votes will be designed in secret and by law will be kept in secret, which means there will be no way of honestly checking this process, you know, just to simply see if it's counting votes honestly and accurately. Now, this is absolutely nothing less than an open invitation to steal any and every election they, and use the term Big Brother or Big Daddy, as you say, but basically the Republican elites, because they were the ones, like you say, will be controlling this, how it's done and everything. This is how they'll do it. This is how it works functionally, from what I've read. Let's use Bush and Gore as an example.
Mm-hmm.
The program will simply take one of every vote for Gore and count it as a vote for Bush. So in other words, the computer program will count all Bush votes straight up and then count one of every five, or it could be one of every seven or one of every 10 votes for the opponent, Gore, as a vote for Bush. And how will we know? We're already set up for this by the ending of the exit polling. I'm sorry. Your guest, Greg Palast, 2 weeks ago?
Sure.
He talked about that. And you said, with no paper trail, like, you know, ballots to look over by hand, like we saw in Florida, the only way to check, the only tool we would have, the only insurance against total fraud or manipulation would be exit polling, which, by the way, has always been used very accurately to gauge the real, you know, voting process. It's always been accurate. They've used it in other countries. They've used it here. And all of a sudden now, like Greg Palast mentioned, it's not accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Are they stopping doing it?
Well, let me say this. So one of the things, I just found it's blackboxvoting.org, blackboxvoting.org. The kind of charges that Greg Palast, and you can go to Greg Palast, PALAST.com, GregPalast.com or blackboxvoting.org. And see the charges that are made about the validity of these new touchscreen voting machines that are under the control of these Republican stalwarts. I mean, these are the men that own these companies that are going to be placing these machines. One of them said, I'll do anything for the Republicans. I mean, he was talking in another context. But what do we see here? I mean, what people believe about themselves and the society they live in, I think, is as important as to what is actually occurring. In this case, there's less and less confidence in the electoral process, that people don't vote in the main because they do not think that it is an arena in which they can affect change. They think that the real decisions aren't made in a democratic manner in any event, that they're made by the big elites. That the major decisions about this society are made behind our back. All we want to say, right in front of our face, always behind our back. It's one of my phrases. So you have this charade of democratic process of voting who's going to be the president, but the big decisions are made when, like Dick Cheney, gets together a secret energy meeting, still fighting to keep us from knowing who was at his meeting. I mean, this is one of the reasons the Iraq War was fought, because who was at his meeting? His pals from Enron, who were holding his hand as and, you know, writing the energy bill that was going to affect the big polluters, who are also the Bush big contributors. So what this says, whether this is all true or not, black box voting, ballot tampering in the 21st century, the confidence in the electoral process has been eroded severely by the Bush experience, by the denial of thousands of African Americans from voting, by having the Secretary of State of Florida, who's in charge of the electoral process, also be the head of the Bush campaign in a state in which the candidate's brother is the governor. And that's where the charge is that the election was stolen. Well, that really is enough to erode confidence in the whole process itself. And the deal is, of course, that Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, you know, the whole country's been turned over to corporations now, they don't care. I mean, they don't care if there's a small pool of voters, because they're going to raise this extraordinary, obscene sum, what Greg Palast called, you know, turning the elections into auctions. So they're shooting like for $160 or $180 million so they can affect the 30 or 35% of the people that still think that there's enough there to bother to go out and vote for. All right, my friend, thank you for calling. Again, that's blackboxvoting.org. Hi, this is WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, this is Paul from Plymouth.
Hi, Paul.
Hey, I got actually 2 points I want to bring up. One, to continue with the conversation you guys have started earlier, I want to thank all the media. The television, the radio, and the print broadcasting. It seems now Congress and the Senate has recognized that we should have a bid process towards work in the Middle East or in Iraq. That's going to happen now, and get Cheney's company, Halliburton.
Halliburton, yeah.
Everything's going to have to be a bidding process from now on. But I wanted to switch gears with you a little bit.
Sure.
I want to talk a little bit about Yucca Mountain. Out in Nevada, that's going to be our new repository for nuclear waste in the near future.
Yeah, which probably never will be, but that's what they've designated it as.
Right, I hope not. I want to let your listeners know that, you know, just recently we have gotten the first dismantling of a plant in the upper Michigan that's come through Plymouth here. And they come in stainless steel containers, and it's all nuclear parts from plants, not necessarily the reactor stuff or whatever, the bad stuff, but it's still nuclear waste that's coming through our towns. Just last week, we had a shipment come through here at 20 miles an hour and made its way down the tracks. And I want your listeners to know that we're going to have, in the next 8 years, we're going to have more and more shipments move down through all our towns that's going to be deposited in the nuclear waste repository in Yucca Mountain.
Where's this shipment going, though? They haven't okayed the Yucca Mountain yet, have they?
No, I believe that doesn't start until, I think, for another 6 or 7 years.
Something like that.
But they are dismantling plants and breaking things down and, I guess, consolidating into areas where it'll be easier for them to ship it, you know, later on.
Mm-hmm.
And
Where is it going?
I don't know. I couldn't get that information, but it came through our town, and a lot of the residents were concerned. Made the front page of our newspapers here, and everyone, you know, waited for it to come down the tracks. But I'm kind of concerned about that. That do we need to be shipping this stuff all around the country, or should we be looking for cleaner fuels and stay away from the nuclear power plant?
Well, I certainly think that they ought to end nuclear generation, I mean, immediately, because every second of every day, they produce more and more nuclear waste that has no place to put it whatsoever. It has, some of it has a, what they call a half-life of 250,000 years. I mean, that's, I always try to put it in perspective. What do they estimate now that Homo sapiens, Cro-Magnon man first came on the scene 40 or 50,000 years ago? And they got to keep this stuff secure for five times that, for 250,000 years. So this is absolute madness. This is this dagger that is at the heart of civilization that is one of these things that people just kind of ignore. I mean, we have no way to solve this problem. They find out more and more things that make this Yucca Mountain Repository in Nevada as inadequate for long-term storage. Nobody in Nevada wants it, including the Republican senator. You know, all the mayors, the whole state is almost in a state of revolt against the idea that they're going to put this nuclear waste there. But they keep saying it's got to go somewhere. Well, it does. I mean, we're screwed. Even if we stop tomorrow, there is no place for it. But the idea that it's like if you had a bathtub is overflowing, and you know it's flowing onto the onto the bathroom floor. It's starting to drip down, and you're saying, what are we going to do? Where are we going to put this water? Maybe we should get some buckets and put it alongside of the bathtub. And someone finally says, turn the bathtub off. Turn the water off in the bathtub. Right.
Right. Hey, you know, Peter. I 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have thought this in high school. But now, you know, I have a daughter, and I start thinking about her future, and where are we going to put the next hundreds and hundreds of years of this nuclear waste? And the whole world, if we're all going to use this nuclear power, where are we going to put all this stuff?
Well, the answer is nobody knows. The Bush administration is trying to get Congress to fund more nuclear power plants. There hasn't been one come online in, 25 years or something? And, in fact, nuclear power, which at first we were told it was going to be so cheap that it wouldn't even be measured. In other words, that it was going to be this miracle. Instead, it has cost the American taxpayer, like almost everything else, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And this is something else, just in the area of nuclear power generation. We had our choice, although, of course, we never realized it because, as usual, we were lied to. We could have had something like, an end to poverty, or we could have had a national health program, or we could have had any number of other improvements to our lives. Instead, the United States taxpayers subsidized this industry that would have been incapable of operating if it wasn't for these monstrous subsidies and guarantees that the United States government gave to it. Again, they were buddies of the people in power. There were these huge corporate interests. They were very frequently the polluters in other forms of fossil fuels, coal and oil. And so we're stuck with this physical mess and this fiscal mess as well.
Can I mention one more thing?
Sure.
I know we're fighting over oil right now, but I sure hope in the near to distant future that we're not fighting over food. That I think that's the next road we're gonna have to fight over.
Well, it might be water. Think about that too.
That's true. Hey, thanks, Peter.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. And following Paul from Plymouth. Hi, night call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Pete, you're driving me crazy here. Well, you say that Bush lied, people died, right?
And, yeah.
And I agree, people died, but when it comes to the reasons that we went into Iraq, I don't think that Bush lied at all. I mean, we went in there to remove Saddam Hussein, which was a threat to the region, to Israel, and a potential threat to the United States.
But how? He had no weapons of mass destruction. He had no programs to develop weapons of mass destruction. And even if he did, there was no indication that he had any intention to attack. I mean, why would, the guy, I mean, most people that head most governments seem to be a bit nuts to begin with. And this guy was pretty nuts. But he was like so many people like that. He knew who he could mess with and who he couldn't. He made a mistake in when he invaded Kuwait because he thought he had the United States approval to do it, or at least the fact that they would look the other way in the same manner that they looked the other way when he used poison gas in his war with Iran. But there, even if he would have had weapons of mass destruction, what do you think makes him a danger to in terms of being aggressive to the United States? Why would he do that?
Well, but like you said, he invaded Kuwait, and even if he thought he had the green light, I mean, he wouldn't openly attack America. But you really don't think that Saddam Hussein might collaborate with terrorists and trade weapons of mass destruction so they could get it here?
Well, why would he do that? I mean, the everything has a footprint, or a fingerprint, rather. And, I mean, he had the ability to do it and apparently stayed completely away from it. I mean, there is no evidence that even after the United States Defense Department under Rumsfeld set up a special division to try to find some evidence that Saddam Hussein was linked to terror groups. They came up with this thing. There was this terrorist training camp in northern Iraq. And then for a while, I was like, see, here's the evidence. Of course, then it turned out that was a region that was under the control of our allies, the Kurds, and not Saddam Hussein at all. So you can't invade a country. You can't kill thousands and thousands of innocent Iraqi civilians. You can't have 2,000 American casualties. You can't rip the American taxpayers off for hundreds of billions of dollars because don't you think he might have? Come on.
Well, I don't have the quotes in front of me, but I'm sure you've seen them, that your president, you know, Bill Clinton and Al Gore and Daschle, Nancy Pelosi, they all said during the 90s that Saddam is a threat to the region and the world, and he has programs of weapons of mass destruction.
I don't know if they did or not. The last thing let's stay in, you know, the 20th century suddenly sounds like a long time ago. Colin Powell in 2001 said that Saddam Hussein represents no threat whatsoever to the region. We have a program of containing him, and it is successful. I mean, that's what he said. Now, one of, this 25-year veteran, Greg Thielman, a former expert on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, his title was Director of the Office of Strategic Proliferation and Military Affairs, says Powell lied to the United Nations.
Well, when Bill Clinton was justifying lobbing missiles at Iraq, he had to give some justification for it, and it was, he said that, because Saddam threw out the inspectors.
He didn't throw out the inspectors. The inspectors decided they were going to withdraw because Clinton was going to bomb it. This is, you know, these things get repeated over and over and over again. I mean, I've interviewed United Nations weapons inspectors like Scott Ritter, who was head of the program, who said, you know, I mean, I knew he didn't have any weapons of mass destruction because I believed people that had been there on site that supervised for 7 years the destruction of these programs that Saddam Hussein had, and said that he said at least he could guarantee that 95% of every weapon that the United States said that Saddam Hussein wasn't supposed to have did not exist. He said he couldn't speak for the other 5%, but he doubted that Iraq had any capacity to create any systems of weaponry, and there were none. We're talking about weapons of mass destruction. That means weapons. Weapons is a noun meaning a specific technology that can be used to strike people. There was nothing like that. And if they find some musty lab, that's not a weapon of mass destruction. This is a Bush hideous lie.
Well, no, but you said back when he was gassing his own people, I mean, those are weapons of mass destruction, and he had them, right? And maybe there's some left over. Or why couldn't he develop more?
Maybe. Well, maybe. But you're going to go kill thousands of people because of a maybe? Now, why wouldn't Bush have waited 30 days, like the French wanted to do, for the inspectors, Hans Blick and the people, who was very hostile to Saddam Hussein, by the way, why wouldn't they give the Blick and his inspectors another 30 days? You remember why? He said, because the weapons that he has are so volatile that he could strike at any moment. I didn't believe that. Why did George Bush believe that, or was he just lying? Is he stupid, or is he a liar?
he didn't want to give him more time, and he shouldn't have given as much time as he did. He should have went in right at the instant and didn't, and not give Saddam more time to hide the weapons.
Well, we don't know that he hid them. They looked everywhere. Look, you know, it's like saying, prove to me that there's no ghosts. Or you could say to me, prove that you're not, that you don't beat up your wife, Peter. And I could say, well, you know, none of my neighbors have ever reported me, and then there's no police reports. Well, you know, you keep your windows closed. Well, here, talk to my wife. Well, you've intimidated her. You know, when you make a contention, you have to show some proofs. There was never a scintilla of real proof, and everyone involved, including the latest guy, who was the head of the people that were investigating all this, said that there was no threat whatsoever. Bush made this up. There never was a threat from Saddam Hussein at all, and there was no potential threat. Bush committed a crime against peace. He violated the United Nations Charter. The people at the United Nations were correct. Bush was wrong. Bush is an illegal, illegitimate president who carries out illegal, illegitimate acts. When you commit a crime, you know, he's a serial criminal. He steals an election, and he figures, damn, the people of the United States bought this crap. They actually allowed me, a guy who came in second, to have his daddy's friends on the Supreme Court steal this election, and they just sit around and wring their heads. And the guy that won the election comes to my inauguration. Damn, I can do anything. I'm going to turn this whole country over to Enron. I'm going to rob the American people, give it all away to my rich buddies and my polluters who contribute to my campaign, and borrow money where we once had a surplus, and these people aren't going to do a thing. Because you know what? He thinks you can fool all the people all the time. He doesn't believe the guy that founded his party, Abraham Lincoln. All right, thanks.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the RIF Cyber Crew. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the RIF on-air giveaways. Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air. Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, that sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the RIF Cyber Crew today. Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream. It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
WRIF.com. More Riff Rock is coming right up.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Amigos and Taylor in Woodhaven.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's five best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save.
With the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com. You're logged on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talk with rock and roll tennis pro Luke Jensen. It wasn't long before we all start talking about his brother Murphy.
What's up with your brother? Just because he knocks up Robin Givens doesn't know what it means.
Oh, man.
That was actually a cheap shot, and I'll apologize for it. Murphy did impregnate Robin Givens. That is true. Luke's
beautiful baby boy, 3 years old.
And is she now your sister-in-law?
She is. No, they are not married.
Are they together?
No, they're not together.
Ooh. Oh. Yeah. Was it even close?
No. Not even close.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
Hey.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101-101-WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Twice.
Hey.
Is nice.
Double your
fun. New Year's Day on the Riff.
Everyone, listen up.
Every Tuesday, 101 WRIF,
the home of rock and roll,
brings you Two for Tuesday. Keep it locked on the Riff all day this Tuesday for back-to-back badass blasts of your favorite Riff rock bands.
Plus, the Riff gives you the hottest tickets to the coolest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Who's your boy?
Two for Tuesday.
Double the Riff rock.
Double the Riff prizes.
Learn it. Know it. Live it.
Two for Tuesday on the Riff from 101 WRIF. If it rocks.
If it really rocks.
Well, begin transmission.
Here comes the music.
It's on the Riff.
We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment. This is 101 WRIF, broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. Thanks for listening.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Antonio's Cucina Italiana, with three locations in Farmington Hills, Dearborn Heights, and Dearborn.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roche, put your best pace and body forward with help from Dr. Roche.
Log on today and save.
With the home of rock and roll.
At WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
I think by God Bush can't finish his job. He was aimed to take care of his dad's problems. Didn't finish that in 91. And he damn sure ain't got this sumbitch finished now.
No, no, it's going to take a long time.
I mean, you know what I'd do, hell. I'd split that son of a bitch wide open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'd use them bomb planes and bombs, and I'd have everybody scared to look up.
But you know, the thing of it is, after all is said and done, we still don't have Saddam Hussein. Can you believe it?
I don't know they're supposed to have his sons, but...
Oh, duh, you don't think they got his sons necessarily?
Who knows whether it's his sons or not.
Did you see the pictures of them?
Yeah, I seen the pictures of them, but all them son bitches look alike. Just picture one and turn him sideways, he'll look like half a dozen more.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
That is.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101.1 WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Riff. You're listening to 101 WRIF Detroit, a greater media station broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. There's more Riff Rock coming right up, so don't go anywhere.
The Emerald Ball.
The Emerald Ball.
The Emerald Ball.
Kick your club life into overdrive. Jumpstart your weekend at the Emerald. The Emerald.
You know, he just, you know, total lack of compassion. Could very well have been stoned absolutely out of his brain on Oxycontin. Contin, right? Let's see. Was Rush Stone when he sneered? This is an article, by the way, from counterpunch.org. Interesting website, counterpunch.org. It's called Should Limbaugh Do Time? I mean, I don't want to see anybody do time for drugs, but hey, man, you know, this is the guy that said people belong in jail for doing drugs. Here's what he said about Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. When you strip it all away, Jerry Garcia destroyed his life on drugs, and yet he's being honored like some godlike figure. Our priorities are out of whack, folks. That's what Rush Limbaugh said. Now you have George W. Bush saying about after this, after it's come out that Bush is getting his drugs, you know, country heroin, you know, with deals in parking lots through his, you know, he's got his housekeeper doing it. George W. Bush says Rush Limbaugh is a great American. Well, wouldn't Rush say that his priorities are out of whack? Limbaugh hasn't died from an overdose on opiates. He may have damaged his hearing and has far less talent than the late lead guitarist of the Grateful Dead. Unlike Jerry Garcia, a most unjudgmental individual, Rush is a flaming hypocrite, the addict who pretends he's superior to all other addicts. The cops have thus far not arrested Limbaugh, who confessed his addiction. Rush blamed it on the after effects of an old operation. Rush Limbaugh says, "I'm still experiencing that pain." Oh, yes, everybody's getting a lot of sympathy for him. "Rather than opt for additional surgery for these conditions, I chose to treat the pain with prescribed medication. This medication turned out to be highly addictive." And the author of this article, Should Limbaugh Do Time, James Bunn, said, "Turned out to be. Rush didn't know opium is addictive and illegal." I mean, that's what I mean. What a hypocrite. In real life, James Bunn said, Rush's lawyers convinced authorities not to arrest the multimillionaire radio host because he really planned to kick the habit this time around, even though he's failed several previous detox and rehab programs. Rush stands in the tradition of right-wing hypocrites who seem to beg to get caught. He demanded that police enforce drug laws against others, that is. When was Rush subconsciously pleading for the cops to develop enough moral fervor to come after him? This is an interesting article. There's a lot to it. On October 10, 2003, Delphia Ricks on Newsday referred to OxyContin as the heroin of rural America and one of the most widely abused prescription medications that addicts snort, chew, or inject to get high. OxyContin was designed as an oral medication to mediate severe chronic pain. And let's see, according to Wilma Klein, Rush's housekeeper and supplier, Rush popped up to 30 pills a day. And he's on the air, folks, and all of you idiots that listen to him, and you're an idiot because you're listening to him, a multimillionaire that is just the mouthpiece for power and wealth. She says he once used almost 100 a day in a month-and-a-half-long binge. And probably every day he was on there telling you, liberals, you know, that was what's wrong with America. Put those drug addicts in jail. She told the National Enquirer that Rush hid his stash under his mattress so his wife wouldn't find them. Others were passed in a Denny's parking lot. Oh, the sleaze of it all. All right, let's go back to our phone calls. Hi, WRIF, this is Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Hi. Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Well, I was just reading an article about Democrats, stopping their tough gun control thing. I was just wondering what you thought about it.
I wasn't quite sure what the question. You mean that the NRA is trying to get the assault rifle ban overturned?
I don't know. I just saw an article, and I was wondering what your opinion was on tough gun control.
Well, I mean, I think most people support gun control, don't they?
I don't know. I mean, if you look in Australia, they supposedly banned guns, didn't they?
I'm not sure. You sound like you've been reading the NRA newsletter. They're always talking about Australia.
I was reading an article on MSNBC.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's now that they're most of the police in the United States, in fact, all of them, the police. What do they call them? Police Chiefs Association, what have you? They asked that they have these laws that allow criminals to arm themselves with weapons in many matters, outgun the police themselves, and so this essentially stopped the importation of these weapons that are only used for murderous intent. And nobody that had a weapon of that variety was asked to return it, and. Now this is coming up for renewal, and the NRA, which is one of the many groups that the Republicans whore out to, are trying to get this repealed. And it's just total psychopathology. This country has more guns per population than any nation in the world. You can get almost any kind of gun you want. To some extent, these laws, I don't even think are too effective, given that the ability of criminals to obtain guns. Of course, I mean the laxity of the laws allows like the DC sniper to wind up with a sniper rifle, and the the gun shop that sold it to him to say, I don't know, we can't, we had about 800 guns stolen, and nothing can happen to them. Or, well, I think that what's happening now, that the law that would punish them, the NRA wants to repeal that as well. They're a pack of psychos. Okay, that's my opinion. You have no comment. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. Mike here.
Hi, Mike.
How are you?
Good.
Good. I guess, with all due respect to all of your callers, because without callers, you don't have a show. But I guess I've heard this thing over and over and over again, how they get turned around. You know, we went into Iraq, and let's be real clear on why we went into Iraq. We went in there to get rid of weapons of mass destruction. So this fallback position of, you know, we have liberated this country is like the equivalent of a, you know, a field goal in football. You know, we go down there to get touchdowns, but we'll settle for a field goal.
Yeah.
And we'll do it at the tune of $150 billion American dollars.
And counting.
And counting.
Yeah.
And I think that all gets lost. I mean, I don't think these people really understand how much money that is.
Well, I think there's two things. It's not a matter of understanding. It's a matter of not really having the full knowledge. You do have to kind of look at this stuff. If you just read the headlines, if you're just kind of passing CNN, or you're sitting around listening to Fox News, where they've just done these studies to show that the more you listen to Fox, the more likely you are to have demonstrable misinformation. Not, you know, not opinions. You can have any opinion you want. But people that watch Fox a lot, I mean, it's inversely proportional. Like, the more you watch Fox, the less you come up with reality.
Oh, I think to that argument, I think you can take it a step further. I hate when people do this, and I'm going to be guilty myself, because I cannot tell you where the poll was done, but 17% of the respondents felt that Saddam Hussein was the person the United States had identified who was behind the plane crashes of 9/11. This is an administration who is rewriting history as we go.
Wait, no. It's like, at one point, it was like 80%. 80% of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein was behind September 11th.
And now, I don't know. You know, Winston Churchill said that, you know, you're born a liberal and you will die a conservative. And I guess I'm going to be one of those people that bucks that trend, because
I'm a far cry
from being 15 right now myself. And it's I'm going the other way. You know?
Well, me too. I mean, I get more radical all the time. When I just came back from this big demonstration in Washington yesterday, and I assigned just kind of a middle-aged, you know, kind of housewife. Look at me. It sounds, who knows? She was a woman in her middle age. I don't know what her occupation was. But in other words, she didn't look out of the ordinary. And she had a T-shirt on that said, "Quit bitching. Start the revolution."
Amen. You know, I mean, this stuff was all done 30, 40 years ago, and we all got fat and lazy about it. And it's time to rekindle that flame, because it's... people, you know, things are being taken away from you. That you, I mean, this Patriot Act, and they want to have a Patriot Act too. And people are just standing in line to hand things over. And we are a knowledge-based society because we're an open society.
Well,
and I sure as heck don't want to see that stop.
Well, most people, Mike, are saying and doing nothing. Most there's an activist core of right wingers. And there is this mass of, I mean, I hate to call myself part of a mass, but there is this mass coherent opposition on the left, but it's never presented coherently. It's called special interests. It's called dissenters, protesters. But the one thing we haven't figured out how to do is to bring what essentially is mainstream opposition to this illegal government that rules in Washington in a coherent form. And, you know, the fact that there's so many of us out here is giving a little bit of courage to some of the Democratic presidential candidates. But, you know, in fact, they sound tougher and tougher all the time, because when they realize how many of the American people also distrust Bush, also realize that he's enthralled to the corporation solely, that you know, that this war was based on a lie, that it seems to be endless and a bottomless money pit that we're all paying for, well, suddenly they're getting a little gumption. Ever seen that bumper sticker, Mike, that said, "If the people lead, the leaders will follow"?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
just
well,
like the lemmings, you know? If we're not careful, we will follow the lead lemming right in, you know? It's wake up and smell the coffee, America.
Thank you, Mike.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye now. Time for a couple more calls, and we'll get to our interview with, what's her name? Laurel, I can't remember her name, but you'll hear it on our interview. She's the producer of the MC5 film. MC5 is not an Einstein equation, but rather one of the bands of Detroit that kind of set the standard for it all. And if you go to my website, you can even take a look at that. PeterWerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerbe.com. Still haven't got that new website launched. We will soon, though. I'm sorry, Rick Fox, line three. All right. Hi, Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, this is Alex. Not trying to suck up or anything, but I listen to your show all the time, every Sunday after work.
Well, thank you.
And what I wanted to offer is an opposing viewpoint to yours on the nuclear issue that you had talked about maybe 15, 20 minutes ago.
Sure.
Now, while I think I'm pro-nuclear, now what I mean by this is not that I think that's the way we should go with all sources of power, but compared to solar power or wind power, it's probably the next cleanest. I mean, after the green power, when you have solar, wind, hydroelectric, I would much prefer having nuclear power to oil or coal. And when you think about it, I don't have exact numbers or facts and figures, but I have read a lot about this, and I have seen a lot on the TV, like the Discovery Channel, which I think is a pretty reliable source, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Well, more or less. But what I have heard and what I've read is that there's been pretty much two major accidents using nuclear power, pretty much Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. But think about how many accidents there's been using, like coal, for example. How many people have died from black lung disease? How many mining accidents there has been? I'm sure the total far exceeds any damage caused so far by nuclear power.
Well, there, you know, there's a couple of ways to look at it. There's been a couple of dramatic things, and certainly Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, particularly Chernobyl, still has these effects. But there's all of these processing plants that and mining and what have you that create these silent casualties. But beyond that, and maybe. We got to end with this pretty quickly, Alex. What are we going to do with all this nuclear waste?
Well, the thing is that the nuclear waste is something that you can see much easier because it's a concentrated form of waste when you think about it. When there's these smokestacks billowing forth all this poison from coal power. I mean, and coal, what a lot of people don't realize is that coal, the smoke that comes out, does have radiation in it. I mean, there's all these trace elements. I've read thorium is one of the major trace elements that you can find in coal that's radioactive. And this stuff just goes in the air. And radioactivity is the most dangerous when it's in particles that emit radiation that you can breathe in or drink in or eat.
Sure. Well, it's also bad when you put it near a major aquifer and it can leach into the water system. Look,
right.
There's no need for. I mean, we could begin if we did like a. You know, they developed the atomic bomb. This is an interesting analogy, and we had a Manhattan Project to end our dependence solely on, or completely rather, on fossil fuels. We could do it. I mean, there's no need to have coal or oil or nuclear. We could move away from it all.
Right, and a lot of things that I've heard is people keep saying, you know, we should go with green power because it's friendly for the environment, which it is, but what a lot of people don't think and what a lot of people, I think, believe unrealistically is that they'll have no environmental impact. I mean, solar power is great, but you're going to need huge tracts of land for the panels. Wind power isn't for every place. You got to have, you know, a windy place, obviously, but it also each individual windmill does not produce all that much power, so you need hundreds of them.
Well, you can have what they call these wind fields where you look at North Dakota. You could generate an enormous amount of power. I mean, people seem to, you know, to think that we could do it. And it's just now in the developmental stage. We know, as you're correctly indicating, the problems with fossil fuel. But uranium and its usage and then its storage is a problem also. I mean, I think that we could use the sun, use water, use the wind, and come out a lot better. Alex, I got to go.
Okay, have a good night.
All right, sorry to cut you short like that, but we got to go. But stay tuned. We'll learn all about the MC5 and the film that's going to be at the Detroit Institute of Arts this Thursday. on October 30th. So thanks for listening. Thanks for calling.
Man, how'd you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of legendary stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make love as long as you want with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Sex is good. Sex with Maxtral is incredible. Prolong the pleasure. Maximize the control with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Introducing Club Keno, a whole new kind of lottery game.
Oh, hidey, hidey, dilly, dighty, 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 do. Oh, I love to play Club Keno.
I play it with me friends.
We're always at our favorite place.
The good place never ends.
Club Keno is exciting.
Club Keno makes me grand.
I love to pick me numbers.
As for me, I love to win.
Oh, hidey, hidey, diddly, diddy, 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 go.
Good times are at your favorite restaurant or bar where you can play Club Keno every 5 minutes, 7 days a week. It's from the Michigan Lottery, but it's not like any lottery game you've ever played before. Find out where you can play. Call 1-877-PLAY-KENO.
I went to play Club Keno,
and all my friends were there.
We ate, we drank, we laughed a lot,
and cheer was everywhere.
I picked my favorite numbers.
I waited for the draw.
When they came up, I won some cash.
Next time, I'll bring me ma.
Call 1-877-PLAY-KENO.
Wild Woody's in Roseville.
The wildest Woody's.
And 101 WRIF presents the grand finale of the Amateur Homemade Bikini Contest.
Join the Roseanne Carlini as the most beautiful women in the Motor City compete for cash and prizes this Wednesday night.
Come watch the fun as contestants model their own bikini creations made out of anything but cloth.
King Halloween is a real scream at Wild Woody's with the Halloween Costume Contest for cash and prizes. Show up in the sexiest costumes and win a $75 gift certificate courtesy of Jay's Closet. Score a big cash prize for the most creative costume, and the scariest costume at Wild Woody's wins tickets to see Godsmack in concert.
Guys, check out the wildest wait staff in town, and everyone can cash in on $1.50 bottles of beer all night long. Wild Woody's. Join the Roseanne Carlini as the most beautiful women in the Motor City compete for cash and prizes tonight.
Wild Woody's. Just minutes off I-94 between 13 and 14 Mile in downtown Roseville.
See Wild Woody's ad in this week's Real Detroit Weekly.
Attention car buyers. Parkway Chrysler Jeep has the absolute best selection of Chrysler and Jeep vehicles. If you want it, they've got it. Like 2004 Jeep Liberty 4x4s, $149 a month. PT Cruisers, only $119 a month. Jeep Grand Cherokee 4x4s for $189 a month. All these vehicles for under $200 a month. Plus, up to $6,500 in rebates. Employee discounts for everyone. Get out of your current Daimler Chrysler lease early. There's more, so stop the music and listen up. Everyone who walks through the door gets employee discounts. And here's the Parkway pledge that sets it apart from the competition. We will appraise your trade-in, and Daimler Chrysler will give you an extra $1,500. Oh, yeah. Appraised value plus an extra $1,500. So get into Parkway Chrysler Jeep this week, because these prices can't last. It's the Parkway Chrysler Jeep end of October sale. Parkway Chrysler Jeep is on Gratiot at 16 and a half mile in Clinton Township. Just show up, sign up, and ride.
Check your local paper for details.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free confidential trial of testosterone.
Call 1-800-807-8108. 1-800-807-8108.
Guaranteed to work for you or your money back.
Call 1-800-807-8108.
Results will vary.
Good morning. This is Ray Vinson of American Equity Mortgage. If you're hearing our message at this time, it's probably because you're at work, driving around, or can't sleep. If you can't sleep, I hope it's not because of money problems, but if it is a money problem, American Equity Mortgage can help. You're not alone. The average household has a credit card debt of $6,000 or more and paying a fortune in interest. You see, if you're a homeowner, you can use the equity in your home to consolidate all your bills and have only one payment. Think about that, just one new low monthly payment. Your equity can be used to pay off your auto loans, credit cards, and get a new low fixed rate on your mortgage. You will be saving hundreds of dollars each month. American Equity Mortgage specializes in homeowners with less than perfect credit. We have helped thousands of people just like you get back on track. You can call our office right now, and a loan specialist will call you first thing in the morning. That's American Equity Mortgage. Call toll-free 888-71-LOAN-1, 888-71-L-O-A-N, then the number 1.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me. It's a real pleasure to bring someone to our microphones on this morning that has put together something that on one hand is both history and memory, but something that also has real relevance for today. This is a rock and roll station, and when it's always important to look at our roots. And part of the roots of Detroit music, and so frequently Detroit music has defined what has become music for the rest of the world, everything from techno and Eminem and Kid Rock today to Motown, but also, if you go back to the turbulent 60s, to grab a cliche, right now, it's time to kick out the jams, like that, and bring to our microphones Laura Legler. Laura Legler is the producer of the film MC5, A True Testimonial. It's directed by David Thomas, and it is going to be in our town October 30th, Thursday, coming right up. Laura Legler, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you so much for asking me. I cannot follow that up. I think you've just said it all. Thank you very much. We'll see you on Thursday.
Yeah, well...
That was beautiful. That was absolutely beautiful. And you just described all of the reasons why David and I have spent the past 8 years making this film. It is about history, and it is about what's relevant, and it is about, you know, knowing history is wrong and not knowing history, or knowing history is right and not knowing history is wrong. That's it.
Let's do this for our 4% of the audience that is clueless to the MC5. I think that has something to do with Einstein or something like that. Yeah.
Well, the MC5, as everyone except that 4% knows, were, you know, one of the original hard rock groups, one of the greatest performing acts in rock and roll ever, and they burst out of Detroit in the late 1960s. Five fellas from downriver who, you know, took their music and their message very seriously and, you know, made quite a stir and now have a legacy that has truly become mythological. And they're known and revered literally around the world, and very, very important in the links of rock and roll. Very important missing link.
Now let's look at the title MC5, which of course stood for the Motor City Five, although
That's right.
Rarely ever were designated as such. But a true testimonial, and part of that has to do with the way they were introduced at different times. But is that true? Is in big letters. I know the drummer Dennis Thompson always felt very strongly. For instance, he told me any number of times that he thought that the true story of the MC5 had never been told. Is that what that refers to?
Well, it's a bit of a play on words. In a sense, yes, that's exactly what it refers to. We wanted to tell a true story. You know, we took the documentary part of this very seriously, and it is also a play on words from J.C. Crawford's great sort of gospel-like introductions that he used to give for the band at their live shows.
Brothers and sisters.
You want to see a sea of hands. That's it. And, you know, it's that was a title that our director came up with very early, before we had ever started shooting, I think before we even had a name for the company or had gotten started at all. He felt strongly about that this was, in fact, going to be a testimonial and a true testimonial. So we use it on many different levels.
And maybe we should give credit to the members of the band, including two that have passed, a real loss to our community, even beyond the MC5 days. The late Rob Tyner on vocals, Wayne Kramer, the explosive lead guitarist, Fred Sonic Smith on rhythm guitar, who also has passed away. Michael Davis, whose girlfriend's round oak table still graces our dining room on bass, and Dennis Machine Gun Thompson doing the drums. An incredible group of guys from Lincoln Park, one of them I referred to it as Fomoco City one time. And it's funny, Laura Legler, when a friend of mine, a teacher, always asks his students, he says, do you think you're living in history right now? And they go, huh, what?
Huh?
And so those of us who were back there in the day with these folks, it's hard to actually understand what you were part of. To us, it was a great rock and roll band to see at local venues and at the Grandy, mm-hmm. a ballroom. And little did we know the impact that they were having. Could you just maybe talk a little about yourself as producer and David Thomas and what kind of impact they had on you and how they came to your attention?
Well, I can, and I'll tell you, that's a very interesting comment that you made, because when we were starting to interview all the people who were in our film, including those surviving members of the MC5 and their very close associates, people who worked with them, their wives, those types of folks, they all told us that it was even miraculous to them that we were able to dig up so many materials about the band, photographs and film footage and all these different things, because they said also at the time they weren't looking at it as if this is all going to go down in history. They were just living life. They were living large at the time, and they never really thought, this is going to have this kind of impact. They never looked ahead that far. It was very much in the moment. So I just wanted to comment about what you said. I agree with you completely. David and I came to this project sort of from two worlds, the rock and roll world and the documentary film world. We knew as filmmakers that this was an incredible story, that it was a filmic story, that there are very few rock and roll bands whose story, their career, their legacy, what have you, can kind of translate into that film world. This story could. And we also knew, as rock and roll geeks, which we are, that they had been written out of the rock and roll history books. We could sense that. There was nowhere to find information about these guys. You'd go to some of the big, rock encyclopedia or what have you, and they'd have some little two-sentence thing, which would be wrong, and that was it. And we thought, well, this is really fascinating. Why, in fact, are they seemingly written out of the history books? And we had lots of theories. They never had a big number one hit. And then we sort of started to learn more about their story and realized, they also had this political stance, which wasn't always popular, and there were just a number of reasons for it, so we wanted to explore that a little bit, and indeed, we do in the film. In terms of the impact they've had on our life now, all I can say is there's no going back. We mm-hmm. have been with these folks literally every day for over 8 years now. And to their credit, they've been with us as well, and we're thankful that they've stuck with it. Luckily, what's happened is we have truly ended up with one of the great rock and roll movies of all time, and it's getting credited as such in countries around the world. So we're just we're blessed and delighted, and we can't wait to bring it to Detroit and hopefully have an impact on the folks there, too.
Well, I know the tickets are going quickly for Thursday, October 30th at the Detroit Institute of Arts, Detroit Film Theater. Tickets available now only at the box office on Farnsworth between Woodward and John R., so you got to get down there and get them. Now, I don't really know how long, it occurred to me, I was thinking about this, about how long it takes for a documentary from concept to finish. Now, this seems like, to use a song title from a band with a lot softer approach to rock and roll, a long time coming.
It is indeed. It is indeed.
Did this take an extraordinary amount of time to get up and going and finish?
Yes, it did. But the answer to that, one of my favorite answers, yes and no. In the documentary film world, there are a couple of truisms. One is funding is never easy. Money is not just readily available. It's hard to get funding for what we consider righteous projects. I think it's easy to get your horrible romantic comedy with a big Hollywood star funded, but some wonderful story that's important historically, culturally, whatever, the money's just not there. You really have to go out and find it. So we took a long. It took us a long time to raise money to do this film. This film was very, very expensive. The other thing is we wanted to be complete in our research, and in order to do so, we not only had to do research in places like Detroit and around the Midwest, and then, of course, as they expanded it to California, New York, and everywhere the band went, but this also included Europe. So we had a European research coordinator who worked with us extensively to dig up footage, film footage and photographs and what have you in many different parts of Europe. Things came to us from Australia. It was really all over the place. So this took an extraordinarily long time. Then what we had to do is we also had to shoot interviews with all these folks. It was a lot of people to arrange. You know, we had to travel to different locations, shoot the interviews, track down people, work around their schedules. And then once that was all completed, which took a number of years, we had to begin editing the film. And fortunately, by the time we were ready to start cutting the film, we had accumulated over 125 hours worth of materials.
Wow.
And we knew that we were going to make about a two-hour film, so we had some serious cutting to do. And I would say out of those 125 hours, half of that was really good material, so we had our work cut out for us. The first cut that we had of the film, I think, was about 25 hours. It was great. No, we had a three-hour cut. We had to just keep whittling it down until it was at a reasonable amount. And that took 16 months, which is about normal for a feature-length film of this depth. This is a very complex film with footage and photographs and what have you. And then, of course, we started the business end of it, which for an independent documentary like us is the film festival circuit. And we were very fortunate that our debut was at the Toronto International Film Festival, very prestigious, that we were just so fortunate to get in. And once that happened, we were invited everywhere. So we traveled to places like Amsterdam and London and Sweden and then San Francisco and New York and all over, really doing the business of film. And that's been 12, 13 months now. And now, luckily, we're moving into the actual business of the film, which is a commercial release.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at your website, or I did earlier, futurenowfilms.com. That's futurenowfilms.com. I'll have that up on my website as well, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E, and you can link to that. And I was noticing all these, as you said, these awards from all around the world, Australia and Sweden and New York, San Francisco, Amsterdam, London. And I kept thinking, okay, release the film, release, and so. But this apparently is the process. Is this partly in order to get a commercial distributor?
Yes.
Okay.
It is. It's to get to all those places where you think your film will find an audience, and to kind of get the ball rolling. For instance, we went to the Munich Film Festival upon their invitation because we knew that there were theatrical distributors who do rock and roll movies there who wanted to see it, and there were broadcast entities in Germany that had heard about it and wanted to see it. Well, the best way for me to do that was to take it there and do the festival. And then we have a theater setting with a wonderful audience, and it's very high energy, and the film goes over great, and we can start the business rolling.
Now, I was just the other night, I was down at the Detroit Film Theater where the film MC5, A True Testimonial, is going to be showing on October 30th, and saw a screening of Weather Underground.
And, great.
Yeah, and actually, well, that's another story. Let's stick. I got to do something I rarely do, focus. And I ran into Lenny Sinclair. Now, Lenny Sinclair, if people do not remember, was the wife of John Sinclair, who was the manager of the MC5, also the chairman of the White Panther Party. And I have to keep reminding people, they supported the Black Panther Party. You know, Laurel, people, you know, we kind of take some things for granted. And I told somebody about that one time, and they said, oh, you know, they took the white people's side, huh? And I went, no, it wasn't a racist group at all.
Oh, ouch. No.
Yeah, it was like the opposite. The first point of the White Panther program was support of the Black Panther 10-point program.
That's right. Anyway, that in our film as well. We do cover that. But you're absolutely right. We heard that a few times, too, and I'm just thinking about a particular extra that's going to appear on the DVD for the film, and someone actually mentions that. They bring that up as a point. So,
really? Well,
yeah.
I saw Lenny Sinclair, and I said, how much of your material is going to be in the film, the MC5, A True Testimonial? And she modestly said, oh, I don't know. And but I suspect that to the extent that she did she do filming? Yeah, she did. That's
she
right.
Did.
That's right. I remember seeing a short trailer, maybe when you guys were just starting.
That was around 1997. Yeah, we had about a 2.5 minute trailer that we brought up to Detroit to sort of raise a little awareness and excitement, and that worked well for us. And I think that you were there that
I was, and Michael Davis, the bassist of the MC5, was there, right?
Yes, he was, and Wayne was there as well, Wayne Kramer, and Dennis Thompson as well.
Glad you don't have to depend on me for remembering events.
I'm remembering all of it. It all comes back.
Yes. Now, presenting this, the story of the MC5, what do you find about it? I mean, to tell the audience who is, some of them are thinking, maybe I'd like to see that. What's compelling about the film? It's you might say, well, it's another rock film. We know how that's going to be. We were great. We made great music, and those were the days. But I suspect there's something more exciting to it than that.
Well, there is something more than that, and that's why we ended up with more than just a great rock and roll movie. We ended up with a truly great documentary film, because what it does, and what I think great documentary films always do, is that you go into a theater or you turn on your TV set at home, and 2 hours later, you know all of this stuff about a person or people that 2 hours before you knew nothing about. It's a wonderful, enriching experience, and that's what our film does with these guys. What we always said is that this film was character-driven, but the character is that guy called MC5, that thing that these five extraordinary people did as a group. And so our film, in a way, it has very sort of archetypal themes to it, very circular themes. There are, of course, themes of dreams and love and loss and friendship and the highs of your career and the lows of your career and all of those things that we as human beings can relate to on a symbolic level or on a very realistic level when they remind us of experiences in our own life. And all of that is in this film because these guys, these young men who were so talented and so brave and so genius, they went through all of these things in such a short amount of time. There are people who have said things about our film like, you know, it's scorching, it's hard driving, it's a roller coaster. And in fact, it is, because we put the viewer through it in 2 hours. It's a lot to go through in a 2-hour period, but it's a wonderful ride.
Now, on your website, futurenowfilms.com, that talks about the MC5 true testimonial film, part of the text here, it says the MC5 became, in their own words, quote, perfect targets for the double cross. So it was, what's that word, not meteoric rise, but what there's something that, it was the shoot to fame and then crash and burn.
Yes, it was.
So it has this tragic aspect to
Icarus-like.
Icarus, thank you.
Flying too close to the sun.
Yeah.
Sure. I think there was a real element of that, and we sort of struck upon that very early in our research of what this was all about, and I think we were right, and I think that you're right.
Now, when you're interviewing people, so many bands talk about the influence everything that the MC5 had on them. Everything from the equipment to the sound to the staging to the activity. I mean, people have to remember that a lot of like jazz guitarists, they would sit on a stool.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And play some of the jazz greats. Suddenly you have this band physically exploding on stage as well. Did you get to talk to any of the people who were influenced by the MC5?
Oh, yeah. That was one of the real rewards of this project, was we got to talk to lots of people like that. And some of them will be on the DVD giving the testimonials. We have testimonial, just little pieces that we shot with everybody from Blue Oyster Cult, which some of the older listeners may remember, to Cheap Trick and Monster Magnet and the wonderful Primal Scream from England and the Helicopters from Sweden and groups like that. And, of course, as we travel with the film, we met all these great rock and rollers. And just try and stop them from telling you about the influence. They want to talk about it. It's so important to them. I mean, they took this stuff to heart. You know, what we realized when we traveled with the film is, as much as the people in Detroit really feel an affinity and a closeness with the MC5, you know, their hometown group, their hometown heroes, if you will, other people in very far parts of the world, they feel that as well. They feel a real affinity with it. And a lot of these young guys, the MC5 records, which is all they've known really up until this point, have taught them a lot, and they internalized it, and then it comes out in some form or another in their music and in what they do. As an example, when we traveled to Gothenburg in Sweden, some of the great, you know, right now Sweden is a very hot rock place, and some of the top groups there, like the Soundtrack of Our Lives and the Hives and the Helicopters and the Sahara Hot Nights, they all did a big party kind of benefit, not a benefit, but a party after the screening, just so they could celebrate the fact that the film was there and to celebrate an evening of MC5 music. It was incredible. So, yeah, you're right. There are groups like that all over the world that this really means something to them.
Now, so many Detroit bands that went on to be national and international hits, I mean, of course, Bob Seger and so many others, Ted Nugent, but it was only the MC5 that kept getting repeatedly arrested, in part because lead singer Rob Tyner would begin with, now it's time to kick out the jams, MF, you know, and boom, the police would descend on. They seemed to always beat up John Sinclair. I don't know, well, they didn't seem to beat up the band so much, but it was always John Sinclair. It's always, I'm sure you have some photographs at least of him sitting in the police car, eyes blackened from the police attacking him. Is there any footage of actual those confrontations at some of those clubs? Did any of that survive?
No, there was no film footage of any of those things in progress. There were photographs of, you know, John Sinclair in handcuffs and John Sinclair in jail and those kinds of things. There's actually a very, very special bit of footage that is one of the extras on the DVD that we didn't even get until the film was finished. We didn't even learn about it until the film was finished. And I don't want to give too much away because it's a very special thing to watch for the first time, but there is footage of these guys as they're being released from jail in California. They had got stopped on the Bay Bridge near San Francisco for, you know, open beer cans in the car or some nonsense or another. And, of course, they got dragged down to jail, and there's footage of John Sinclair in the car going to bail them out. And it's pretty great stuff. But, no, unfortunately, no footage of the actual riots with the police. But lots of stories about that, and some of that you'll see in the film as well.
Actually, maybe this will tickle a few people. If you go to fifthestate.org, that's the old underground newspaper that I used to work for, still exists, Fifth Estate, like the number, you know, Fifth and Estate, like real estate, fifthestate.org, and there's an... is it there? No, wait a minute. Oh, I'm trying to... There's an account of that bust that when they were out in San Francisco. I'm trying to think if that's the place where it is. Yeah, take a look there. If not, send me an email and I'll tell you where to go. This is all going to be extraordinarily exciting. And I suspect, like the film Weather Underground that I saw, this is going to be those of us from back in the day, and it's also going to be teenagers.
What's
the reaction, if you're able to tell, from younger people who it's not nostalgia, it's not remember, oh yeah, I remember, but this is almost brand new?
Well, it's in a way, it's everything that you would expect. It's absolute joy. It's mouths agape. I get emails that say things like, after the screening, I just wanted to run out in the street and tear the stuff up. I think it's exactly what you would expect. There is that same excitement level, that same sort of feeling that there's something slightly dangerous about all this that the kids just love. And they're still seeing that. They're still feeling that. So you're right, it's not nostalgic, but they're getting in some small way a sense of what you folks felt and experienced, when it was actually happening.
Well, I think, too, don't say this critical at all of so many bands around that try so hard, but most bands function very self-consciously. In other words, that now there is a route from what they're doing currently in a small club in Detroit to stardom, and they're very aware of this, whereas it really was lived for the moment. That if you would have asked the MC5, do you think in 30-something years there's going to be a documentary about you, they probably would have looked at me like I was crazy.
Right. Right. Well, I think that you're right about that. They probably would have thought that sounded a bit strange. But I think it's also important to remember that the MC5, while they were doing what they were doing, it was for the moment, and it was about having a good time, and it was also about carrying a message. They felt very strongly about that. They felt if you have the privilege to get up on stage in front of an audience, you better have something to say. But they also wanted that success, and rightly so. They were musicians. They took their job very seriously. They were studied musicians, and they were phenomenal. You know, they should have had huge hits, and they should have had a lot of success. And still to this day, you know, it's there's an amount of sadness to that they didn't have more success. But on the other hand, it's all coming back around again. You know, it is all a circle. It's 30 years later, and I think they're perhaps more popular now than they ever were.
Mm-hmm.
That's my sense.
Here, I finally cleared up my fogginess about this article about the MC5 bust in California. If you go to peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, go down to the bottom of the current site and click on a little front cover of the Fifth Estate. That will take you to the page where you can find this account of the MC5. I'll tell you one memory of mine that brings together the Fifth Estate and the MC5. They used to practice in the basement of the Fifth Estate office by Wayne State University.
Yeah.
And they would be playing there with all their equipment while we were laying out the weekly edition of the paper. I mean, how our ears ever survived that is way beyond me now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You'll see that building in the film.
Really?
Yeah, and then with Wayne talking about, you know, the Fifth Estate newspaper offices were here, and the Committee to End the War in Vietnam had an office
here.
And the MC5's rehearsal space. And, well, it was, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's Lenny Sinclair footage that we got that from.
Right now, where the Fifth Estate office was, actually it's a parking lot, but right near there's a housing development that says Freedom Place. Then it says no motorcycles, no colors, no something. And it's got about eight things you can't do.
Freedom,
yes. Well,
the new freedom in America.
I
love it.
I haven't even begun to bore you or the audience with my MC5 stories, but I'm going to leave that for the film. And this is going to be an incredible experience. I'm just looking forward to it to the extent I can't begin to tell you. I know that since Dennis Thompson, the MC5 drummer, is in town, he's probably going to be there. Anyone else going
to? Well, yeah, Dennis will be there. Michael Davis and his wife and family are in the process of moving to California, so he is completely tied up, so he's not going to be traveling. And so this is really Dennis's event.
That's good.
Wayne won't be coming, but we will, you know, Becky Tyner, who is in the film, will be there with the Tyner family, big extended Tyner family, which is wonderful. And I think that some of Fred Smith's family will be attending as well,
mm-hmm.
seeing the film for the first time with all of us in Detroit. So there'll be a lot of special guests, and let's not forget that after the film, if you want to hang out and talk or ask questions, we'll be having a party down the street at the Magic Stick with Nova Driver from Detroit, who we love very much.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of cheers, a lot of tears, I suspect, as well, particularly
always.
With the family, as some of the members of the MC5 have passed. FutureNowFilms.com is where you can learn more about MC5, a true testimonial. One more time, Thursday, October 30th is the date, the Detroit Institute of Arts, the Detroit Film Theater. Tickets now only available at the box office. I'll be there. I suggest you do as well. We haven't probably introduced you enough times to give you the credit for this effort that you've put together. Laura Legler, who is the producer of the film, also her partner, David Thomas, who is the director. So it's time to kick out the jams. Thank you so much, Laurel.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks so much. We'll see you on Thursday.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the RIF Cyber Group. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the RIF on-air giveaways.
Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air.
Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, this sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the RIF Cyber Crew today.
Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream.
It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
WRIF.com.
More Riff Rock is coming right up.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Amigos and Taylor in Woodhaven.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to
area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's five best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Your log on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talk with rock and roll tennis pro Luke Jensen. It wasn't long before we all start talking about his brother Murphy.
What's up with your brother? Just because he knocks up Robin Givens doesn't know it means. That was actually a cheap shot, and I'll apologize for it. Murphy did impregnate Robin Givens. That is true. Luke's
beautiful baby boy, 3 years old.
And is she now your sister-in-law?
She is. No, they are not married.
Are they together?
No, they're not together.
Ooh. Oh. Was it even close?
No. Not even close.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
Hey.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's Riff.
101-101-WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Riff.
Twice.
Is nice. Tuesday on the Riff.
Everyone, listen up.
Every Tuesday, 101 WRIF,
the home of rock and roll,
brings you Tuber Tuesday. Keep it locked on the Riff all day this Tuesday for back-to-back badass blasts of your favorite Riff Rock band.
Plus, the Riff gives you the hottest tickets to the coolest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Who's your boy?
Tuber Tuesday.
Double the Riff Rock.
Double the Riff prizes.
Learn it. Know it. Live it.
Tuber Tuesday on the Riff. From 101 WRIF.
If it rocks.
If it really rocks.
Well, begin transmission.
Here comes the music. It's on the Riff. We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment. This is 101 WRIF, broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. Thanks for listening.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Antonio's Cucina Italiana, with three locations in Farmington Hills, Dearborn Heights, and Dearborn.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roach, put your best pace and body forward with help from Dr. Roach.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll.
At WRIF.com.
Hello.
At this strange period in history, suddenly we're confronted by the other, with a capital O, those people from the Middle East and Asia that appear to be out to get us. And the feeling is, of course, we recently just got them. Well, to understand them, to understand the other, takes some doing. History did not begin on September 11th. The contest, if you will, or the differences between the East and the West go back a considerable amount, and I think it's incumbent upon us, if we're going to make informed decisions and not just follow what the latest headline is on the cable news, that we know about what we speak. And I've found extraordinarily valuable this new, essentially a reader, and that's the name of it, the Middle East and Islamic World Reader. It's edited by Marvin E. Gettleman and Stuart Shar. And my guest is Marvin Gettleman. He's the co-editor as well of the best-selling anthology, Vietnam in America. He's emeritus professor of history at Brooklyn Polytechnic University. Marvin Gettleman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. Thank you for being with me.
Delighted to be here.
Now, Vietnam and America, that anthology, I was shocked to learn, time flies, that that came out first in 1965, right?
Yes, indeed. And just after the U.S. Sent American troops into Vietnam in March of that year.
And you were the editor of that, and that continues to be in print.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Still useful. College courses are offered on the Vietnam War, and it's a good source to teach from.
And is there a connection, in a sense, either in the motivation for you writing these or in a sense of getting an understanding of a world most of us normally wouldn't understand?
Well, yes, there is a connection. Doing the Vietnam book, I found that it was useful and readership appreciated making available material that only specialists know. But to do that, what you had to do is contextualize it, describe what the documents and materials are that you were presenting, as I did in the Vietnam Reader, the Vietnam Anthology years ago, and kept keeping it up to date. And that's what Stuart Shar and I did in this Middle East Reader, too, presenting materials that are, if known at all, only known by specialists, but revealing materials about the development of 14 centuries of Islamic history that precedes September 11th, 2001.
Mm-hmm. To grab a cliche, do we not know about the Middle East and the Islamic world at our peril? I don't mean that we're going to directly suffer anything physical, but rather as citizens of a democracy trying to make decisions, what we get as standard fare in the major media doesn't seem to satisfy me, and I suspect with you as editing this book, it doesn't satisfy you either.
Well, the Middle East is drenched in history, and as you mentioned in your introductory notes, lots of Americans think that history began in September 11, 2001, whereas what really happened was that horrendous event, and I speak as a New Yorker, few miles north of the Ground Zero, a tremendous event takes place in the context of a long prior history, and that history is not completed. The Middle East is an unfinished body of work, and how it will finish up and whether it will cause more disasters is to a great extent now in the hands of American policymakers, and I'm worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Middle East always is presented to us as very exotic. On the cover of your book, The Middle East and Islamic World Reader, we see the central image in some ways, the most colorful, is a pair of eyes shrouded by many women in the Middle East wear, to cover everything but their eyes. That's the women. The men are seen as rather wild people, given to shooting off guns in the air at the slightest moment.
We don't have such people on the cover of our book.
No, I didn't. No, I'm sorry. You do not have that. But I guess what I'm saying, that's the common image. How do images like that appear, and how difficult is it to combat them in the sense of trying to create something sensible?
The only way to combat these stereotypes is information. Now, we didn't design the cover of the book, and that veiled woman is an image that we debated whether we should ask to be removed. But everybody said it's such a striking image.
It is.
But most Islamic women are not veiled.
Hmm.
Only about 15% of the population, rural women, for example, are rarely veiled. Working class women are rarely veiled. And so the veiled woman is both a reality for part of the Middle Eastern population and also an example of one of the stereotypes that characterizes Western views of the Middle East. And it's one of many, and the idea that Middle Eastern men are camel riding Bedouins leaves out the fact, for example, that The city of Damascus in Syria is probably the oldest existing habitated city in the entire world. So a good part of the Middle East is urban. And recent events have destroyed a good deal of that urban structure in one Middle Eastern country, that is, of course, Iraq. And so what we see and what specialists see who study the Middle East is a very varied kind of society, not reducible to this desert Arab image. And that complexity is necessary to understand because very, very important decisions are going to have to be made very soon about the reshaping of the Middle East in the wake of the current Iraq war and Americans who will have to pay for much of this, of what we're heading for, had really better understand the Middle East before we get too far into the project of remaking that region.
Well, Marvin Gittleman, just in what you've said, it sounds like you have a very specific point of view on the Middle East, yet within your reader about the Middle East and the Islamic world, you certainly have points of view from all over. I mean, George W. Bush, Ariel Sharon, people, you know, as well as Islamicists. And what gave you the idea to present such a varied point of view? I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is that you could come out maybe as confused as you went in. I mean, should you believe George W. Bush and Ariel Sharon, or should you believe, you know, they're opposites?
Well, I don't think books are made solely to convince readers that the author and editor of the book is right. And certainly books on complex subjects like the Middle East should not be one-sided. Yes, I have a point of view, and it happens to coincide with my old collaborator, Stuart Char, and but it's important that readers... I mean, readers are smarter than we think they are. And when they get one side of a story, I think they get a little concerned, and rightly so. And therefore, I think what we present is a varied mix of points of view, and I think we have confidence enough in our own point of view that people, that we feel that people can read opposing points of view and still come around to our point of view. But if they don't, certainly they certainly learn a great deal about the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. The people in the Middle East that are implacable opponents of the West often refer to the West generically as the Crusaders, hearkening back a thousand years or more for when the West, invaded the Middle East once before. I don't know. I don't want to ask leading questions now that we're trying to present both sides. But
you raised the question of the Crusaders, and it's quite correct in that that phrase has been revived. And in particular, we have a fatwa, a religious judgment that is signed by Osama bin Laden, an amazingly brutal and horrible fatwa in which he describes the Americans as crusaders and calls for their death. Now, that's one of the readings in the book that we put in, not because we want to convince anybody that Osama bin Laden is correct in this belief that Americans should be killed wherever they're found, but it certainly does give a picture of one segment of Islamic opinion in the current stage. And we want to, I think Americans are puzzled by this. They don't like to be hated. And I think they want to know, as in fact Stuart and I want to know too, and our students that we teach want to know, where did this hatred come from?
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of the aim of our book. I think that people will be surprised to find out how recent it is.
How recent?
The origins of this hatred of the West and the feeling that the West is somehow out to destroy the Islamic world.
Now, how recent? Because, of course, there was a great resistance to the colonialism of the 19th century and into the 20th century by the West, France and Britain particularly.
Well, colonialism rolled into the Middle East piecemeal. The heartland of the Middle East was not colonized until after World War I, although parts of North Africa were nibbled away, and pieces of Islamic territory that belonged to the last remaining ancient Islamic state, the Ottoman Empire, were taken over by the Tsarist Russian regime in the late 19th century. But Arabia and the holy sites to three monotheistic religions, these come under Western domination only during and after World War I. And during that time, the Zionist project became adopted by the British, who emerge with the French as minor partners, as the major colonial powers in the Arabian regions of the Middle East. And that is, I think, the beginning of the period in which the West becomes suspicious to Middle Easterners.
Mm-hmm.
Arabs in that region were enticed by the British, particularly T. E. Lawrence, the famous Lawrence of Arabia, who enticed Arab officials of that old Ottoman Empire to revolt against that empire, and gave vague assurances of the creation of independent Islamic states from the Arab territories of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was a Turkish empire and not an Arab empire, which language was Arabic. And at the end of World War I, those promises were only partially satisfied. Actually, the only major piece of real estate that went to an Arab leader after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire in 1922 was Iraq.
Hmm.
And so under British influence, Iraq became a kind of dependent kingdom, dominated by British authorities who were getting very interested in oil in the Persian Gulf region and appreciated the fact that Iraq had all this oil. And that stirred up opposition. And part of that opposition was the hope that kings would be swept away, that a secular society would come to characterize the Middle East as it did some pieces of the Middle East. That is, the portion of the old Ottoman Empire that's called Anatolia became the modern secular nation of Turkey. And Turkey inspired many Middle Eastern nationalists, including those who overthrew the monarchy in Iraq. And there was a belief that a secular state could be forged. The major actors in this were military men in Egypt, like Jamal Abdel Nasser, and the people in the Arab Baath Party, which Saddam Hussein came to dominate by trickery and internal terror and so on. So So the old way was bad, as many Middle Easterners saw it, but the new system that emerged in some regions of the Middle East, Syria, Egypt, Iraq, and so on, turned out to be not so good either.
My guest is Marvin Gettleman. He's co-editor of the Middle East and Islamic World Reader, and it's published by Grove. You can go to groveatlantic.com to find more about it. We were talking about Middle Eastern hostility towards the West and viewing us as a reincarnation of the 12th century crusaders. And you mentioned also about the British and their support of a Zionist project in the Middle East, which came to be the State of Israel. And how talk a little, if you would, about the reaction within the Islamic world towards Jews. Initially, they, of course, lived there in the same region, and they, let me let you take it. Now, of course, that Jews are lumped with the Western crusaders as targets of people like Osama bin Laden.
Of all of the topics that are not widely known in the Middle East, about the Middle East by contemporary viewers of that region, I think the extensive and unprecedented tolerance for diverse religious groups in the Islamic Middle East is the least known. The Quran, the holy scriptures of Islam, mention Judaism and Christianity quite respectfully and favorably. And that argument, that set of assumptions in the Quran took institutional form in the institution called the Dhimmi, which was characteristic of the earliest Islamic empires in the Middle East. And that meant a protected community. The early Muslims divided non-Muslims into two large groups, two unequal groups. One of them were Jews and Christians who had a kind of earlier inkling of the true monotheistic God, whose name in Arabic is Allah, but it's the same God that Jews and Christians, believing Jews and Christians worship, and believers in these religions that have scriptures, people of the book, they're called in the Quran, are given a respectful place in early Islamic societies, right up until the end of the 19th century. They have a great deal of autonomy. They have to pay higher taxes. They're ineligible for military service. In many places, they're not allowed to build buildings taller than the nearest mosque. But the Islamic State protects them and gives them rights to be ruled by their own leaders and practice their own religion unhindered, except for that architectural point that I mentioned earlier. There are also polytheists, believers in many gods, and those are the people who are tend to be forcibly converted to Islam. Islam did not generally forcibly convert Jews or Christians, and in fact allowed throughout the Arab Middle East and Muslim Middle East Jews and Christians to live in general peace. I mean, during the period when there were periods when there was a religion in Europe, the Islamic world was a model of contrasting toleration and hospitality to non-Islamic peoples. Even famous scholars like the Jewish rabbi known as Rambam, Moses Maimonides, flourished and was honored in the Islamic world, did much of his work in Cairo. Islamic imperial centers.
Well, has the perception, though, of Jews gone from tolerance to what would you say, hatred or opposition since the establishment of Israel?
Well, long before the establishment of Israel. Remember, Israel doesn't come into existence as a formal state until 1948, whereas the Zionist movement begins in, at least in its modern form, in the late 19th century. And in our book we have selections from the text of early Zionism, particularly the book The Jewish State, written by the Austrian journalist Theodor Herzl, which is the beginning of Zionism. What we also have in this book is the first Arab responses to the early Zionist project. And some of these texts are available nowhere else in English other than in our book. And so the early Zionist settlements in British Palestine are seen as extrusions of European imperialism, who are using the Jews to extend European power. So hostility to the Jews essentially begins in 1917, the year of the Balfour Declaration, although you have advance notices of it in the 25 years before that, when Zionism is allowed to implant itself in certain regions of the Middle East.
Well, let me say this as we come to an end of this extraordinarily interesting introduction, I would hope, to many people, to your book, The Middle East and Islamic World Reader, that when we go through this variety of incredibly compelling and, as you said, not essays not available anywhere else, what are we left with other than perhaps this feeling of despair in many ways? I guess there's a lot of exuberance among some people about what they consider to be the liberation of Iraq, and certainly none of us can mourn the passing of a brutal dictator. But so much of what we've seen, and there seems to be this gulf in between the Islamic world and the West.
Well, it's certainly easier to overthrow Saddam Hussein than it would be to build a viable state in Iraq. And the United States is really, that is, the U.S. government, is caught in a serious dilemma here, because the images it has of the Middle East really conflict with the current realities. And the attempt to impose something that Washington pundits now call democracy are, I think, doomed to failure. There are democratic forces in the Middle East. Secular and religious Muslims who believe that Islamic radicalism is a distortion of the true faith of Islam. Certainly it's a violation of centuries of Islamic toleration, which I mentioned earlier, but these people are turned off by the way in which the United States is going about creating an imperial presence in the region and using the reconstruction of a very Iraq that was destroyed to a great extent by American armaments as a device to enrich American businesses. Those kinds of motives, I think, do not go over well in the Middle East, and it was a tremendous missed opportunity that the United States did not wait for a international community to emerge and assist in the very necessary process of building a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. You have two choices, people. One really is just keep watching CNN and taking the headlines and thinking that's all there is to it, or dig a little deeper and get a little more responsible in terms of a dialogue and about the direction of democracy in this country and what impact we have on other countries. The book is The Middle East and Islamic World Reader. It's edited by my guest, Marvin Gettleman, and his co-editor, Stuart Shar. It's available from Grove Press. Marvin Gettleman, thanks for being with me.
Quite welcome.
Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby and produced by OD. Stay tuned for more Riff Rock coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Man, how'd you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of legendary stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make love as long as you want with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Sex is good. Sex with Maxtral is incredible. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Hello, I'm Sven. Sven from Sweden. It's not hard to pronounce. I'm here to tell you about a great new instant game from the Michigan Lottery. It's called The Best of Svens. Is that a great name for a game or what? It's named after...